meeting with the House Interim Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules, and the Senate Interim Committee on Rules and Executive Appointments. It is Wednesday, August 13th, 2008, 4 p.m., at Pendleton City Hall in Pendleton. Co-chairs are Representative Rosenbaum and Senator Devlin.
We'll open the Senate Interim Committee on Rules and Executive Appointments. Senator, soon to be Representative Rosenbaum, will you open your committee?
Yes, thank you, Senator Devlin. I will call the meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to order.
How we will begin this is I wanted each one of the members of the committee here to just give a very brief explanation of who they were, what their districts are, so that people in the audience understood who the members were that are here today. Senator Farioli, the Senate Republican leader, will be joining us any moment on the phone here. I believe he's either in John Bay or maybe in Salem, but he will be joining us shortly. I'm Senator Richard Devlin. I chair the Senate Interim Committee on Rules and Executive Appointments. I represent Senate District 19, which is Lake Oswego, Westland, Tualatin, two small communities of Durham and River Grove, and a little bit of lower southwest Portland. And I'm also the Senate Majority Leader. Let's go to the House. Yes.
And good afternoon. I'm Representative Diane Rosenbaum. Represent District 42, which is in southeast and northeast Portland. I serve as chair of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules, and also as the Speaker Pro Tem of the Oregon House of Representatives. And I'm very glad to be here with you in Pendleton.
I'm Representative Sal Esquivel from Medford. In fact, we only have 14 constituents outside the city limits in my district. I am not only a member of this committee, but I am also the Vice Chair of Business and Labor in the House.
My name is Chip Shields. I represent Inner North and Northeast Portland, and I'm proud to represent the district where Senator Farioli grew up.
Do you want to say where that is?
In Northeast Portland.
Okay. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Senator Ginny Burdick, and I represent the people of Senate District 18, which is a big chunk of southwest Portland and Tigard and King City. And I chair the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, and I came in the same class in the Senate as your very own Senator, Dave Nelson.
I'm David Nelson, and I know most of you folks, or at least recognize you. State Senator from this district. I represent four counties, Morrow County, Umatilla County, Union County, and Wallala County. It's like 175 or 80 miles from end to end and about 100 miles north and south. And there's about 114,000 people in that district, and they're all great people.
We decided to have this hearing in this location because after Senate Bill 10 was passed, we had obviously some ramifications from its passage. Many of the emails we received, many of the telephone calls we received, many of the letters that we received came from Eastern Oregon, although the letters, emails, and telephone calls actually came from all over the state. One of the things I would point out is that Senate Bill 10 was an entire reform of the ethics laws in this state. The bill is approximately 40 pages long, although the portion of it that actually changes statute is much shorter. It simply takes 40 pages to simply cover all the different portions of Oregon Revised Statutes that the bill covers in terms of changes. Any time that you pass a reform that is that sweeping, it has unintended consequences. And I think obviously one of those unintended consequences were the number of resignations that were received from various boards, some cases elected officials. Our intent here today is actually is to hear testimony, and my intent, and I believe the intent of the chair of the House Rules Committee, is to basically hear testimony here today, the same as we heard testimony earlier this summer in Salem. We'll be having another hearing, I think, sometime within the next month, month and a half, submitting legislation in the next session to make amendments to the statute that was passed. We're not going to promise at this time what those amendments will be, but it's very important we hear from you what your concerns are. I know a lot of people are angry, or at least they were angry, about the legislation, and you have every right to come here and express that anger, but the most useful thing to us is to tell us what you believe was wrong with the bill and how you believe it should be corrected, or if you believe something was right with the bill but you thought was something that needed to be done, to tell us that also, because our purpose here is to gather as much testimony as we can along those efforts, because this became a very broad issue in the Capitol, which the governor became involved in, the Speaker of the House became involved in, and the Senate President. A review panel was set up, and we're going to have the first party to testify who was a member of that review panel. Ms. Taylor, will you come forward? Ms. Taylor was probably one of the most well-thought-of members of legislative staff in the state capitol. Then she went to the Department of Administrative Services, and I will be kind and not make any comments after that.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for that.
But actually, the review panel worked with a number of organizations, including the League of Oregon Cities, the Association of Oregon Counties, the Special Districts Association, I believe the Oregon School Boards Association, the Confederation of School Administrators, and actually the Law Commission, and I believe with the Commission on the Legislature, in terms of looking at the legislation and seeing what recommendations they might make. They took a very straightforward view of their role. They actually indicated they would not tell us what to do, but I think they did something very good in the sense that they said, these are the problems that we think need to be addressed. Here are three or five options on how they could be addressed. And with that, I will turn it over to Ms. Taylor.
Thank you very much, Chair Devlin, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marjorie Taylor. I'm a senior policy advisor with the Department of Administrative Services. Chair Devlin, geez, you just gave my first page of testimony. But again, thank you for the opportunity to share the work of the Ethics Reform Review Team. For this presentation, I've tailored my comments about the report, the team findings, and possible options to reflect the majority of concerns heard by the team. In April, legislative leadership asked legislative council to partner with staff from the governor's office, the attorney general's office, and the Department of Administrative Services to review the implementation of ethics reforms approved in 2007. Legislation enacted during the 2007 session was historic in that it was a major and complex reform effort on a body of laws that had been in effect for more than 30 years. The team met with officials from the League of Oregon Cities, the Association of Oregon Counties, the School Boards Association, and other local governments to gather information about the impact of reforms on their constituents. Team members also met with the Oregon Law Commission to gather background and history related to reform recommendations made during the 2007 session. Our team met with the staff of the Government Ethics Commission to learn about the timeline, the process of implementing the legislation, including drafting of administrative rules, creation of new forms, education and outreach, and response to concerns from public officials as they were filing all of their SEIs and quarterly reports. Finally, our team, with the help of League of Oregon Cities and Association of Oregon Counties, asked affected local government officials and the general public to provide written feedback about the impact of these ethics reforms. The team received more than 250 comments, including more than 200 on behalf of local government officials. And as I pointed out to somebody from Beat Falls, my gosh, I think we heard from every elected official from that town. The majority of comments concern the statement of economic interest and associated quarterly reports. The theme in the comments was consistent.
The revised SEI and quarterly reporting requirements were excessively intrusive in private matters and applied to too many public officials. I'll speak about five major concerns outlined by local officials in their comments. However, our full report, which was made available to you and is available to your audience, includes other concerns identified by the team. The first concern was relatives. Public officials expressed concern about the new expanded definition of relative and how inclusive it is. Officials considered the list of relatives to be intrusive and didn't understand how the Ethics Commission might use this new information. Officials also raised concern for personal safety and identity theft when providing this information to GEC. Others commented that their relatives didn't seek public office and therefore should not have to be included on these forms. A second concern was privacy. Officials expressed that some information required on these SEI forms was too intrusive, including the names of relatives and also the sources of income. Others said that the SEI could serve as a tool to those who are seeking to harass public officials. Some also expressed concern about revealing business partnerships on their sources of income and that would expose them to their competitors. A third concern was the voluntary nature of service. Many noted that local government officials serve in governing bodies or on planning commissions on a voluntary basis. And comments that we saw noted that volunteers may see the SEI and quarterly reporting requirements as burdensome and therefore not volunteer for service in the future. A fourth concern was the internet access. Current law requires that this SEI information be accessible and searchable on the internet by 2010. People commented that this will heighten the intrusive nature of the reporting and increase the risk to personal safety. The fifth concern that I'll highlight today is overriding the will of the voters. Ethics laws were approved by voters in 1974 in a ballot measure that established certain reporting requirements for public officials. However, the reporting requirements did not apply in those communities that didn't approve that ballot measure, and again, those were counties and cities. People commented to us that the ethics reforms were ignoring the will of the voters. After the team identified a list of concerns, again, a full list of concerns is in the report, the team also identified a list of options available to legislators to consider in the event that you choose to modify the current law. The list of options in the report is not exhaustive. However, it reflects a variety of possibilities for each one of these concerns, and it also includes some of the recommendations that we heard from public officials along the way. With regard to listing relatives on the SEI, the team identified five options. First, delete the requirement. Second, restrict the requirement to target specific concerns, such as require a public official to identify their relatives who live within their jurisdiction. A third option would be to create an exemption from public disclosure if the public official notes that there's a safety concern. A fourth option would be exempt certain officials, such as judges or district attorneys, from the reporting requirement. And a fifth option would be to direct the Government Ethics Commission to put more information on the form about why they're gathering this information about relatives and what it will be used for in the future. With regard to posting the statements of economic interest on the Internet, first of all, the Government Ethics Commission does not have the ability to post those on the Internet right now. However, people are concerned about the use of this personal information for negative purposes. Some options to consider include, one, eliminating the requirement to post SEIs on the Internet, two, to restrict information that's posted on the Internet, such as include information about the public official but not necessarily their relatives, and a third option would be to create a secure, searchable website. With regard to listing the sources of income, for some filers, it wasn't clear what it was they were to report on the form. Was it the sources of income? Was it the amounts of income? Was it both of those? Also, the form asks for the five most significant sources of income, and some people don't have five sources of income. So therefore, they were confused as to whether they had to include garage sales or birthday money. With that, options to consider are perhaps specify a minimum amount to trigger the reporting, such as more than $1,000 or more than $5,000 or whatever number you choose. And the second option would be limit the reported income to just that of salary or compensation related to employment. With regard to those cities and counties who did not have to file the SEIs prior to this year, team members heard that local government officials believe that ethics violations are a problem only at the state level. However, statistics from the Government Ethics Commission that were collected over a seven-year period, and that was 2001 to 2008, show that 42% of complaints that they processed were related to city and county officials. And another 40% arose from actions by officials from school districts or special districts. So options to consider are, first, allow jurisdictions to opt out as they were previously allowed. A second option would be to add special districts and school districts to those who have to report on SEIs. A third option would be to review the list of agency heads who are required to file SEIs. A fourth option would be to exempt smaller jurisdictions from filing requirements, such as cities under a population of 1,000 or counties under population 5,000, or whatever you set. And the fifth option would be to exempt public officials who are not compensated for their duties. Although the list of concerns and options that are raised today is not comprehensive, it illustrates some of what the Ethics Reform Review Team heard while we were gathering our information. And again, with passage of Senate Bill 10 last session, the legislature undertook a major and complex reform effort on a body of laws that had been in effect for 30 years. Ongoing review and adjustment of the substance and implementation of those ethics laws may be necessary. And thank you again for this opportunity, and I would be happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you. In your discussion on the relatives issue, in your discussion of ways to limit it down, you said perhaps limit it to relatives within your jurisdiction. Did you have any discussion of limiting it in other ways, for example, limiting it to relatives who actually did have a legislative interest?
Chair Devlin and Senator Burdick, yes, the Ethics Reform Review Team also understood that if a relative had a legislative or administrative interest, then certainly if they lived outside of the jurisdiction, it would be important for them to be listed on the SEI. But we heard a number of concerns raised by public officials who have family members who live either far away out of state, who live out of the country, who they haven't been in contact with for years, and it just became very troublesome for some of the public officials to include that information on their SEI.
Chair, to follow up, what was the rationale for including all relatives within a jurisdiction, even those who didn't have a legislative interest?
Chair Devlin and Senator Burdick, the Ethics Reform Review Team was just trying to identify some options to consider, and again, I believe that was one of the options that was proposed by a number of public officials. Again, trying to provide more information, but not as much as, hey, I have a relative who lives in Florida who has nothing to do with me, but at least here I have three relatives who live in my city who may or may not have a legislative or administrative interest, but at least I'm identifying who my family members are.
Senator Nelson, and then we will go to actual public testimony because Ms. Taylor actually is only a couple hundred yards from the Capitol and obviously can come over to the committee anytime we need her to testify. Senator Nelson.
Hey, guys, just with these new reforms or these proposed new options, do they encompass any of the findings from the law commission that was set up prior to the hearings we had last year in which we basically ignored everything that the Law Commission came up with to come up with this new law. Are these new options part of that old Law Commission findings?
Chair Devlin and Senator Nelson, I think if you take a look at the report, you might be able to find some recommendations that could be similar to those of the Law Commission and what they proposed during the 2007 session. But again, the Ethics Reform Review Team was primarily focusing on the comments that we received from the public officials and just looking at those major concerns and trying to provide you with some possible options. Again, we don't want to give you any direction. We just wanted to give you a broad set of options to consider.
Thank you very much, Ms. Taylor.
Thank you for the opportunity.
What we will do now is we will go through the list of people that have signed up to testify. We've had a couple requests from people that signed up here because of other conflicts to be able to go at certain times, so we'll respect those. And looking down the list here, I noticed that Representative Bentz is here to testify, but I wanted to indicate to him that he is more than welcome to join the committees here at the dais if he would like to.
Thank you very much. I was just going to testify, and then if I can join you, that would certainly be okay. That's acceptable. Or whatever you...
Okay. Representative Bentz, why don't you testify, and then I will go to Mr. Kramer and Mr. Or let me see. Then I will go to Bill, Commissioner Hansel, and then Mr. Kramer.
Chair Devlin, Chair Rosenbaum, my name is Cliff Bentz. I am the State Representative for District 60. And thank you very much for being here today. It's great seeing you all again. And it's interesting, as I travel my district, which is 26,000 square miles in size, it took that many miles to scrape together 57,000 people. There's an awfully lot of small towns. And town after town after town mentioned to me one way or the other the difficulties they were having in finding people to serve given these new requirements. They all indicated they were greatly interested in doing their best to be transparent, but they also all indicated that they were very concerned about issues involving disclosure of family members. And there were lots of remarks about how many of their family members might not want anyone to know they're related just because of where they were serving. In fact, my family members made that remark to me. But I would simply say that these people are horribly concerned because there's a very small pool of people that serve. And if we make these situations challenging, as a quarterly report does, and if we make these situations challenging by having to disclose many things that they have a hard time understanding the reason for, we reduce that pool even further. And it's a difficult situation for your committee committees to be charged with, and it's a challenging opportunity, I will call it. I would hope that the one of the options I didn't quite hear, but in the list of options, is to maybe put off the disclosure of the family members until a complaint has been filed, because I'm a bit at a loss to see why we would need to have 5,000 or 6,000 people disclose their relatives when the number of complaints may be in the dozens. So if we could somehow delay that disclosure until there's actually a complaint filed, that would be very helpful. My hope is, of course, that the quarterly report in certain instances would not be required, because, again, the paperwork and the challenge for a lot of these folks in these smaller communities is kind of outweighs the nature of the job that they're being asked to do. And again, I want to emphasize that transparency and disclosure is important to us over on this side of the mountains as it is everywhere else. I would just say that we are challenged in the number of people that are willing to serve. And once again, I want to thank you for being here. It's great that the legislature has visited this side of the state. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Bentz. We will now go on to Commissioner Bill Hansel. And then we will go to Mr. Bill Kramer.
Chair Devlin and Chair Rosenbaum and members of the two committees, good afternoon, and thank you for coming to Pendleton. With me is Paul Snyder, legal counsel for AOC, and ask him to join me here. My name is Bill Hansel, and for 26 years I have served the people of Umatilla County as county commissioner. I'm the second longest currently serving commissioner in the state. I've had the honor of serving as president of the Association of Oregon Counties and a couple of years ago as president of the National Association of Counties. I mention this because I hope my experience as one of the longest serving elected officials at any level in Oregon, and particularly in rural Oregon, will be of some benefit to you as you consider the changes to the ethics legislation. Growing up on a wheat and cattle farm some 20 miles north of Pendleton near Athena, we pretty much worked under the premise of the old adage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Many of us feel the ethics laws first enacted in 1974 by the voters of Oregon were not broke. Some tweaking might have been needed, but the legislative overhaul of the last session created a system that is now broke and does need to be fixed. I applaud your efforts to listen and to try to fix it. If the 09 legislature does not act with some meaningful changes, you will find many citizens will be unwilling to serve any longer. Let me summarize some of the parts I believe need to be fixed and some suggested solution. I have four areas. Number one, the statement of economic interest. The new SEI and the quarterly requirements are excessive and intrusive. Specifically, three things. One, internet access. This mandate to have everything on the internet by 2010 is a most intrusive piece of legislation. The records are public and they can be obtained upon request, but the opportunity for harassment from someone surfing the web is very real. Unpopular decisions are made every day somewhere in Oregon by judges, law enforcement, planning commissions, and elected officials. Why would any of us want our information listed on the internet to those who would want to do us harm or just harass us? The fix. Eliminate the requirement that the SEI be posted on the internet and keep the SEI available upon request as it has been for over 30 years. Secondly, listing of relatives. First of all, this is redundant because I'm already required to list them in the conflict of interest laws when there is a possibility of a problem. The SEI requirements are troublesome and in most instances make no sense. I had to list relatives all over the nation and I have no idea why. I have concerns about their privacy and safety. The fixes I see are to remove the requirement. Or, as has been said earlier, if you have to have it, then target specific concerns. For example, list only those relatives who live at home, or live in your jurisdiction, or who have a legislative or administrative interest in your governmental agency. The third area is including those jurisdictions who opted out in 1974. Again, this is viewed by many as being very intrusive. The voters spoke in 1974. But in 2007, the state legislature paid no attention. Citizens in the rural areas were fine with the existing laws. Under the new laws, people are unwilling to volunteer and serve. Let me read a comment from a Pilot Rock City Councilor, John Stanley. Can the state, and I quote, can the state give any examples as to why they felt they needed to do this way? We would like to be treated as respected volunteers who have been doing a great job before most of them, i.e. state legislature, showed up. And as serving as a mayor for 20 years, county planning for 3, city councilor for 3, I am very dissatisfied with those who are minding the store, implying that our character needs to be in question. Fixes. Allow the voters of any jurisdiction to opt out as they could in 1974. Give the citizens the opportunity to decide if they want their elected officials to have to fill out the SEI forms. Secondly, exempt smaller jurisdictions and or volunteers. Second area of concern is the quarterly public official disclosure QPOD forms. Quarterly reporting is unduly burdensome, particularly for volunteers, and more R&R for elected officials, that is, more restrictions and more reporting. And if you don't, you will be fined. One of the Umatilla County Planning Commission members who had never filled out a form was late in getting his in. He was fined $250. He has since moved out of the county, but when he was asked to serve on that county's planning commission, he said, no way. The fix, eliminate the QPOD. Slight changes in the annual SEI could add all the information needed. Eliminating the QPODs would also cut down on the workload of the Ethics Commission staff considerably. The third area of concern for me are definitions. Legislative or administrative interests. The definition is too broad and inconsistent. Secondly, public official. The definition applies to anyone who is serving a public body, either full-time or volunteer. The scope of the definition needs to be narrower. And thirdly, gifts. To be honest, this subject has created all sorts of gamesmanship. The aggregate value has been placed too low, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. A couple of suggestions. Remove the aggregate concept altogether, or increase the aggregate amount. Secondly, only require reporting of any gift over a specific amount, and make that amount reasonable. The fourth area of concern is the need to exempt from reporting activities and reimbursements received from associations of governing bodies. The reason I list this is because I'm not clear as to whether or not such an exemption exists. For example, the 36 counties of Oregon formed an association over 100 years ago, primarily to lobby in the state legislature. We are members of the Association of Oregon Counties. AOC certainly has a legislative and administrative interest in each county, and each county official, I might add. But that is why we joined together. The cities and special districts have the same situation. All of us have national organizations to which we belong. If the National Association of Counties asks me to testify before a congressional committee, which they have done, NACO will pay my way to Washington, D.C. to do it. Because of the nature of this association, I contend I should not have to report every dime of this trip. I believe an exemption should be made. Out of form was late in getting his in. He was fined $250. He has since moved out of the county, but when he was asked to serve on that county's planning commission, he said, no way. The fix, eliminate the QPOD. Slight changes in the annual SEI could add all the information needed. Eliminating the QPODs would also cut down on the workload of the Ethics Commission staff considerably. The third area of concern for me are definitions. Legislative or administrative interests. The definition is too broad and inconsistent. Secondly, public official. The definition applies to anyone who is serving a public body, either full-time or volunteer. The scope of the definition needs to be narrower. And thirdly, gifts. To be honest, this subject has created all sorts of gamesmanship. The aggregate value has been placed too low, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. A couple of suggestions. Remove the aggregate concept altogether, or increase the aggregate amount. Secondly, only require reporting of any gift over a specific amount, and make that amount reasonable. The fourth area of concern is the need to exempt from reporting activities and reimbursements received from associations of governing bodies. The reason I list this is because I'm not clear as to whether or not such an exemption exists. For example, the 36 counties of Oregon formed an association over 100 years ago, primarily to lobby in the state legislature. We are members of the Association of Oregon Counties. AOC certainly has a legislative and administrative interest in each county, and each county official, I might add. But that is why we joined together. The cities and special districts have the same situation. All of us have national organizations to which we belong. If the National Association of Counties asks me to testify before a congressional committee, which they have done, NACO will pay my way to Washington, D.C. to do it. Because of the nature of this association, I contend I should not have to report every dime of this trip. I believe an exemption should be made for such activities. In conclusion, in rural Oregon, our governments run on volunteers. Without them, many programs and governments would cease to exist. We should be trying to create incentives for people to serve, not creating disincentives. We had round one with lots of resignations throughout Umatilla County. My little town of Athena, we lost our mayor and a councilman who was a state trooper. They were two very good men. The county commissioners had to appoint new counselors to the Ukiah City Council because so many resigned they did not have a quorum. These are but two of many examples from Umatilla County. For many who did not resign, they have told me that they are waiting to see what the legislature is going to do. However, if the legislature does not act, we will have round two, and many good people who have faithfully served will be gone. We will all be the losers. There have been consequences, intended and otherwise, from the 2007 legislation that need to be fixed. Public service is a high calling, and many are waiting and will be watching to see what the legislature does. What is done or not done will make or break many rural governments in Oregon. Thank you for your consideration. I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Commissioner Hansel. I did have one question about your comments about opting out, and you are suggesting that any jurisdiction be allowed to opt out or returning, because I just wanted to clarify the way it had worked previously was that areas where the original proposal had not passed with the voters were allowed to opt out. So I wasn't clear if you were talking about broadening that or just returning to that?
Well, returning to that in some form or fashion. If the local jurisdiction, and I don't have necessarily the way to do that, but given the opportunity to decide if they, the way it was decided before, if they voted negatively, then they weren't in. Some way, maybe be proactive and say, look, we're going to, this is it. We'll give you an opportunity to decide whether or not you want that applied to your jurisdiction or not, let the voters say whether or not they want to do it. Some way like that. Is kind of, I hope I've answered your question, Chair.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the matter of internet access, do you think it would be acceptable or reassuring to have these reports available electronically, but only for people who requested them and were on record as having requested them, so that if something, so there's some accountability there. So you could either do that through a secure website, or you could do it through a request and then sending the reports out electronically. Do you feel that that would alleviate some of the concerns?
Senator Devlin and Senator Burdick, it might alleviate some, but I think the general feeling is that there's not an internet safety factor that cannot be broken and cannot be done. We hear people cracking them all over the United States, supposedly secure things and records are being divulged. I think I, for one, would just as soon not have it on there at all. They can still get the records if they want to, and they can request them. They're still public, but I think any internet has the potential of creating a situation that I personally would not like to see. So maybe it's a cop out, but I just feel that we shouldn't even go there, regardless, because I think at some point, if a person really, really wants to, or just as a game, can crack it, and it'll get done now. So. That's me,
yes, Chair. And on the matter of relatives, assuming that the definition of legislative and administrative interests can be refined and made clear to everyone, do you think it would alleviate the concerns among some of these people who have resigned or might resign if the only relatives that have to report are those that you would otherwise have to disclose in a conflict of interest statement?
On Chair Devlin and Senator Burry, on that issue, yes. If that was the only issue that a person had that resigned, if you answer that, then yes, I think that would be narrow the scope, put it more reasonable. I don't know why, again, I had to list my son who lives in Cincinnati, Ohio. If he lived at home or was a lobbyist or something, I could see doing that, but he doesn't, so on. And I've got a son-in-law who is a police officer in Sacramento, so I had to list him. And I think that would, on that issue, yes, that would help tremendously.
I listed a relative that I hope he never finds out.
Just for the record, our intent here is to take testimony from 4 to 7 o'clock. So we're going to limit testimony at this point to 5 minutes per individual. If we get a large group of people come in after 5, we will limit testimony for new people coming in to 3 minutes each. So I just wanted to be aware of that, and the committee to be aware of that we've got quite a number of people to go through. Yes, Senator Nelson.
Of course, yes. With all your years of experience, do you feel this law needed to be changed?
No, I did not. As I said in my testimony, there may have been some fine-tuning, but I personally did not feel I did not feel it needed to be changed, especially to the extent that it was. Chair Devlin, Senator Nelson, sorry, I did do the proposal.
Was there anything additional you wanted to add? Briefly, Mr. Chair, if I may. For the record, I'm Paul Snyder with the Association of Oregon Counties, Chair Devlin, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the two committees. When the Oregon Law Commission had its work group during the interim between 05 and 07, it included voting members and advisory members. I was one of the advisory members. The question came up in the conversation here this afternoon, why did the Law Commission recommend expanding the list of relatives? The Law Commission was faced with a fork in the road, and my recollection of it was one direction was to be more transparent and provide more information about people and relatives. The other direction was to be severely limiting in terms of the kinds of gifts that could be received. The Law Commission took the former. They suggested that there should be more transparency, but that the gift limitations should not be narrowed. In fact, a couple areas they recommended expanding them. That's my recollection of where the commission went, but Senate Bill 10, I think, married the two concepts together. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll now go on to Mr. Kramer, and right after Mr. Kramer, Mr. Ormond.
Chair, please identify yourself.
I will. Chair Rosenbaum and Chair Devlin, my name is Bill Kramer. I'm the presiding judge for the 24th Judicial District, which consists of Grant and Harney counties. But I'm here because I'm the current president of the Oregon Circuit Court Judges Association. My remarks focus only on judges, but I don't mean to take away from any of the other concerns of the other individuals here concerning the statement of economic interest. Let me say that judges are different than other elected officials. A basic function of our job is to resolve disputes, including criminal, family, and juvenile cases. These at times can be highly emotional, and litigants, defendants, and their families can act inappropriately. Some have mental disorders or are sociopathic. The very real safety risks to judges have long been recognized, in particular by the legislature. It is an unfortunate fact that judges are attacked and even killed due to the nature of the work that we do. Ironically, last March and April, just when this first requirements were coming out, I personally was threatened with arrest from a fringe constitutionalist, Freeman Posse Comitatus, anti-government individual, if they didn't like my ruling. And in a separate case, just a month later, a criminal defendant whom I sentenced to jail threatened my life. Now, some threats are more serious than others, and I don't want to tell too many war stories, but this was an individual who was, in fact, dying of cirrhosis of the liver. And so his statement that I'd have nothing else to live for, you're going to put me in jail, because he showed up for court for an arraignment on a DUI, intoxicated, carried a little bit more weight than perhaps some of those type of statements in the past. In the past, as I indicated, the legislature has recognized that judges are placed at a higher level of risk than many other elected officials, although all face concerns. And in the past, has allowed judges to exempt disclosure of their home address, phone numbers, and the like from Department of Motor Vehicle record disclosures, and other public registrations. The legislature has authorized funds for court security purposes to provide for safety to judges and the public attending judicial proceedings. And my point in making that statement, I'm not going to read all the way through my statement's just the first three pages, and some of the other attached documents really refer to some of the incidents and letters that judges have received. But my purpose in making that statement is that it appears that we spend, I think, millions of dollars to provide security, and then simply by providing certain disclosures undo much of what was intended by providing for that court security purposes. I do want to point out that there's been a recent activity where it refers to economic circumstances by the filing of false property liens, garnishments, and judgments that have been filed by individuals against judges whose intent was to harass individual judges. And, for example, in Appendix 215, you'll see that fake 1099 forms have been filed against the judge in Josephine County as of last month. These types of things continue to occur. And by expanding the disclosure requirements to include relatives, I can't think of a better way to really harass a judge than to begin filing these types of documents against a judge's relatives. Judges are also different than most officials when it comes to conflicts of interest. Each judge is subject to the ethics rules for attorneys and judges. I suggest the Oregon Rules of Professional Conduct, which governs both judges and attorneys, and then the Oregon Code of Judicial Conduct, which governs judges, are the most restrictive and comprehensive rules of any profession. Compliance is enforced by the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability and the Oregon State Bar. These comprehensive rules ensure that there should be no and would be no conflict of interest, and to ignore them places a judge at the peril of suspension from his work and loss of license to practice his profession, which I think is a stronger incentive than any of the rules that have been passed. As an additional basis of protection to anyone who might appear before a judge, the law allows individual litigants to disqualify a judge from hearing any case if they file an affidavit stating that they believe the judge is prejudiced against them. And for those of you who know, in practice, that's all you have to say. You file the affidavits. You don't have to identify any specifics. You just simply state, I don't think this judge can be fair, and they're removed from the case. And you can do that to at least two judges in any litigation if you're a party. I'd also suggest that just the nature of lawsuits, judges are not legislating anything. They're simply interpreting law and resolving disputes when those come before them. A lawsuit generally would involve intensive discovery by parties on both sides, and if there were any concerns about relationships with judges and relatives and third parties, those are going to be discovered just through the intensive depositions of discovery that would normally take place if there's concerns about financial concerns. I'm going to rely on my written materials. I'm actually impressed by the materials that were prepared by the review team. I think they are also assist you. Let me just identify very quickly for you then the appendix. Appendix 1 has just a listing of reports of security threats against judges over the last 4 years. And then I just pulled out, and I did this, and again, I'm here on behalf of the circuit judges, out of a stack of reports that's probably more this thick, I just pulled out different things to give you just a sense of some of the information that and threats that judges have to deal with. I hope I'm not up to my 5 minutes, but let me summarize. In summary, judges face heightened safety risks and are likely to face forms of harassment arising from the work we do and the personalities of a few individuals who appear before us, and it only takes one individual to create harm. The public's safety checks to assure judges are impartial, from the most comprehensive ethics rules and enforcement programs to the right to remove judges at a litigant's choice in any individual proceeding. Therefore, I propose that judges be removed from filing the Statement of Economic Interest. Alternatively, as a security and safety issue, I am asking that certain information be exempt and prohibited from public disclosure. Specifically, as a first priority, any information concerning judges' relatives and personal identifying information of the judges themselves. And if you took the time to read through all the incidents, you would see that there are incidents involved threats to family members and incident where one judge was attacked in public with his daughter as a result of a case that he had handled. Secondarily, any banking information that could be used to file faults, garnishments, and liens should be withheld as well. Under this alternative scenario, the Oregon Government Ethics Commission would still have the information. And if a legitimate concern was raised and information provided to the commission could investigate and or notify the Judicial Fitness Commission about the information, about the complaint, so it could be investigated in a full manner. And I suggest that that would certainly protect the public. I've hurried through a little bit, but I will attempt to answer any questions that anyone might have.
Thank you, Judge Kramer.
Questions?
Yes, Senator Nelson. Yes.
Do you feel there was any need to change this law, the original ethics law?
The existing law prior to the changes? I don't. I think judges have always felt, just because of the nature of our profession, we were uncertain why we were lumped in with all other officials. Again, we don't legislate anything. We simply interpret the law that the legislature has passed, and the executive branch enforces it, of course. But just given the nature of the type of work we do, the type of individuals that come before us, I think I would say on behalf of my fellow judges, we don't think we should have ever been included, but having been included, certainly the law that existed was much preferred to the current form. Thank you very much, members of the committee and chair.
Excuse me, just a moment. Judge Kramer, I just wanted to ask you, we did, at least on the House side, I know, accommodate some requests that were made by the Judicial Department. Specifically, we were asked not to include some of the travel and lodging limitations because they would interfere with judges' ability to get continuing education. I don't, however, remember this issue being raised. Do you happen to know if it was, and if not, why not?
Well, I don't recall it being raised. In talking with those that we work with in the legislature, including Mark Nelson, who has assisted the circuit judges with legislative issues, it did not appear that this type of requirement, from what we were being told, was going to pass. I've gone back and reviewed what did take place, and it was literally 2 days before the end of session when this Senate Bill 10 with these reporting requirements were placed back in. I think I can go so far as to say we didn't think it was an issue that was going to go forward, and suddenly it was placed back in and passed without any of us actually being aware that it was occurring. So, or else perhaps more response would have been made.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Kramer. Now we will go on to Mr.
Senator Devlin.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Shields.
Your Honor,
Judge Kramer.
Thank you, Your Honor. A few years back, there was, I remember reading a story about a federal judge who I believe is still on the bench, who had a financial interest, had some stock, and then was ruling in a case where his stock would be affected, and then there was some type of fine that happened because of that. And I'm just trying to get a sense of how it seemed probably that the system worked in that particular case before this law, and I'm just wondering, are there financial disclosures that need to be made by judges? Did somebody happen to notice this, or do you have any sense of how somebody would know if a judge had, you know, $1 million worth of shares on a dispute that they were overseeing in court?
I would first say that I think that judge had a good law practice before they went on the bench. But certainly there could be dishonest judges who can be hiding information. My point is that I would think in that case, and this is just my own opinion, that if due diligence is being done by attorneys in depositions and those types of things, that normally that kind of information would come out. I think the securities litigation is an extremely narrow field. So I would not think that it would arise in many circumstances, but that particular judge has a proactive duty to recuse him or herself from the case. And in not doing that, they're subject to not only being fined, but I would think disbarred, which they lose their profession if that occurs. So it's not that it can't occur, but I just think there's all these other laws in place that actually would create a larger penalty.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Judge Kramer.
All right, thank you.
Now, Mr. Ormond, Ron Ormond. After that, I hope with the indulgence of people that signed up a little bit earlier on the sheet, our host has a conflict after this, so I was going to go to the panel that he's on. The mayor of Pendleton has a conflict, so I'm going to bring up a panel of three after Mr. Ormond. Mr. Ormond, if you please identify yourself for the committee.
Yeah, I'm Ron Ormond. I'm the mayor of Butte Falls. It's basically 410 miles from here. I drove up here basically because I heard this was only going to be the last meeting and there wasn't going to be any other meetings over on the other side of the mountains. I missed the June 22nd meeting. I was out of the state. I've held office in Oregon off and on for almost 20 years as mayor of Butte Falls. I was elected in 1970 the first time around and sat there until 1983. And I retired when I left, and then I went off working, and I retired, and I came back to Butte Falls in 2000 and ran for office again, and here I am. 1970s, I was there when that first ethics laws were passed. I myself actually voted for it, although the town voted not to become a member. And that was in 1976. We followed all the rules, the regulations that were set forth by the legislature back then. We recorded it via ordinance. We canvassed the votes. We're not a very big town. We're 400 people. Out of the 400 people, there was 130 registered voters. 122 of them voted. The measure, the people decided they can keep an eye on their own individuals. Since then, they have implemented, the city does have an ethics law. We all divulge all our holdings, whatever, when we're in office. I've lost all my council members. Basically, they all resigned when they had to have their relatives put on the individual reporting. I have two left, but they were appointed after April 15th. According to them, they're going to quit by November's election because they're not going to fill out the form either. So just to let you know how we do it, they're going to appoint somebody, two people, and they're going to stay till April 14th. And we're going to play this until it gets corrected somehow. I had to transfer all of our funding, I used the budget committee, the council in our charter has a broad authority, and they transferred the financial oversight to the budget committee since there wasn't going to be anybody on the council. So basically, it's me and the budget committee and two council members. It's really kind of wrong, and I have been very outspoken about that to probably Senator Devlin. I don't know if Representative Rosenbaum has got my letters. I know the League of Oregon City has, and they've got them from everybody in town and everybody that was on the council. Before coming up here, I called the people that had resigned, the two that were there, and asked them, and I presented them with a memo that I got from the League. And they've set aside, and I imagine they're going to talk to you about it. They have four items that they said they're going to recommend. So, and the council, the members thought that was the correct way to do it. Just reiterate, one, just before they quit, one of the members' daughters came to the meeting. She says, "I don't want my mother putting my name down on the list because of my ex-husband." And her mother honored that agreement, and her mother quit that night. So that's want, so we've agreed to what the league set off. What I've handed you is some other things that are a little more interesting that we talked about. Item number one, the false swearing. You've already heard from everybody about the internet and their names being put on it, and that maybe somebody who has more than the average person on the city council in View Falls, they may have stocks that they don't want to list, and they would be tended to not put them down. Now, under the false swearing law, under your new law, you've quoted that as being a 64, a Class A misdemeanor, and actually a $6,400 maximum fine and 1 year in jail for failure to do the paperwork. I think that's a bit, I don't know the word I want to use for that, but it's a bit much. I can see if somebody's intentionally lied in a criminal prosecution being charged for that, but just putting it down, I mean, if somebody owns AT&T and Halliburton and all the rest of it, they may not want to divulge that and then have it show up on the internet. That should be addressed somehow. I don't know how you would do that, but it should be addressed in a manner that that individual's privacy rights would and his papers would be protected. The other issue was, and you'll note on there, I do cite a few of the ORSs in on the lobbyist side. I thought 171.764 is an interesting one. If you haven't read it, it basically says if the public official and the lobbyists apologize for what they've said on a paper, they can use it as a defense. I just thought it was interesting. That's why I put it there. The Ethics Commission, number two, I can understand why the law was written and not having oversight from maybe the governor or whoever, but we're all sitting here, and pardon me for saying, but local government's kind of in a mess right at the moment. And there's really nobody that legally can do anything. At least that's what I was told. And that's what the four people that had resigned, and my planning commission also resigned, by the way, said, what's going to happen? How can we get back in and take office again? I said, there's nobody, you know, if you don't follow the form, you're liable. Nobody's saying that, okay, you can get back in office and we're going to put it on hold, because nobody has the authority to say that, apparently, is my understanding on this.
Can I clarify on that? Because you're a city in your home rule and you have a charter and it says how you do appointments, but you don't have a quorum to actually do appointments, is that the issue?
I don't have a quorum of anything. Now, actually, we have a unique city charter because we're supposed to have six members, but when they wrote it just because it's a small community. We can go all the way down to two. But we're one of the most unique areas that I've ever seen as far as that goes. The problem is that the people that have resigned who still want to become public officials again don't want to fill out the form, and we're all sitting here talking about the problems with the new ethics law, yet there's nobody that can actually sit there and waive the new ethics law till this gets straightened out, if you can follow my train of thought on that. And I think there should be at least somebody or some way, mechanism to do that. Put it on hold because nobody has the authority to say that, apparently, is my understanding on this.
Can I clarify on that? Because you're a city in your home rule and you have a charter and it says how you do appointments, but you don't have a quorum to actually do appointments, is that the issue?
I don't have a quorum of anything. Now, actually, we have a unique city charter because we're supposed to have six members, but when they wrote it just because it's a small community. We can go all the way down to two. But we're one of the most unique areas that I've ever seen as far as that goes.
The problem is that the people that have resigned who still want to become public officials again don't want to fill out the form, and we're all sitting here talking about the problems with the new ethics law, yet there's nobody that can actually sit there and waive the new ethics law till this gets straightened out, if you can follow my train of thought on that. And I think there should be at least somebody or some way, mechanism to do that. The other issue is number three on funding. I don't particularly worry about how you all want to fund the Ethics Commission. I mean, we already pay money to DEQ and all these other agencies. If we have to pay money to them, that's fine. The problem I have is I don't think the Ethics Commission should be the one that sets the percentage. And I don't think, and the council didn't think, the people that I came up, that we talked to, they don't think it should be a legislature process that sets the percentage and maybe the scale. I mean, a town like Butte Falls, 400 people, dogs, cats, and whatever, we don't need to be sitting there saying, okay, it's going to be a percentage of your budget. That's kind of vague. And especially when you're giving that authority to one group, and especially since you have no oversight over it. I mean, if you put the two together, then you can actually sit there for abuse of power then. I mean, that's an issue I have personally, is that if I was, I'd love somebody to sit there and say, okay, Mayor, you decide how much it's going to be. Have a good time. I mean, I would have a whole lot of people upset with me if I went above and beyond what I thought was right. So I think there should be a way of controlling that. The Ethics Commission maybe can purport it to the state, and then the legislature can either approve it or disapprove it, maybe. I don't know. But how you funded it, I just think there should be a little more control. I don't think the commission should have a freelance kind of attitude on that. And the last one is the voters' rights repealed. As you can read, I'm a very voter-conscious person. I believe that people have the ultimate right to what goes on. I do that. I run the city like that. Any major issues, we vote on it. I have no problems putting things on the ballot measure in the town of Butte Falls. I feel that they have the ultimate right to say so how their town runs. They did this vote in 76. It happened to be the centennial, 100 years of our country. And I just have a problem with how this was handled. I really would have thought that this legislature or whoever designed this would have said, why don't you have a revote? I mean, it's been 30 years. I know that. Things have changed. But it's still the same. I mean, It hasn't changed that much. Granted, I have a cell phone, whatever, but I had a portable phone back then too. Of course, it was a big old box, but I had one. But it's still there. It's all the same. People don't change. If you're going to have a crooked politician, you'll have one. And in the city of Butte Falls, he's going to stick out like a sore thumb. And the people knew that when they voted for him. I mean, I voted for it back then. I'm pretty sure I did, because I was actually 27 years old. I was probably one of the youngest mayors in the state of Oregon, except for the mayor of Portland, who kept trying to steal it from me, but he finally agreed that he was the biggest city than we were, so it was fun. But I was 27 when we won back then, and I was very much into the government and everything else, and I still am. I'm a still believer in voting. And that's basically all I have to say, and that's what everybody sent me up here for. So It was a long drive. I spent a lot of money in Mayor Hoke's city. I hope he enjoys it, because I got the lights on at least for another 2 days for him. But I respect you folks for having this meeting. I really do. I have a lot of irritated people in Butte Falls. A lot of them are irritated about this. They came up to me and asked me, I thought we voted on this. I said, well, you did. Then I told them it didn't count. And then I got other reactions. So, anyway.
Well, thank you, Mayor Orman. We will actually have testimony again sometime in the next month and a half in Salem.
Okay.
And we'll actually try to teleconference, if possible, some testimony from other portions of the state at that time. So there will be another opportunity.
Because I know some of my ex-council members would really like to testify at this. I have at least six people and quite a few citizens that would like to talk, but they just... You know, they couldn't make this trek up here, so.
And I will tell you also that because of the complexity of this issue, the chair of the House Rules and Committee and I have discussed this. We haven't actually completely come to agreement, but I think what we will be doing is introducing a couple of placeholder bills, basically, that might have some reforms in them or some modifications of the law. But we will just have those introduced early so that we can continue to work on this issue, so that when we go into session, there'll even be more hearings then. But our intent is to try to get a product before both legislative chambers, I hope, by the middle part of February, which is really ambitious.
That is one of my main questions from a lot of people. They'd like to know if or when you're going to try to correct this problem. I don't look at a city government, me being in charge. You know, I like all the six council members sitting there, and it really is not the way to run a city. And we just don't get anything accomplished. So I thank you for listening to me, and I hope if there's anybody...
Senator Brown has
a question.
Thank you. You've raised some really important other issues as well. From your perspective, is it mainly the reporting piece that's been the frustration for your city council members and your planning commissioner members? Is that the main issue, is the statement of economic interest reporting piece?
Yes, ma'am. That was one of the areas, the main concern of at least the four that quit, and the relatives. That those were the two biggies at that time.
Thanks.
Yes.
A follow-up question for you. And you raised the issue of the voters voted on it, and in the 70s, and I think that's a legitimate point. When we were crafting the legislation in the 2007 session, I personally, and I don't know how my colleagues felt, I had a hard time justifying the sort of patchwork approach of certain cities and counties not complying and other cities and counties in compliance. If we were actually to send this proposal out to the voters, which had not occurred to me, do you think voters in this day and age would pass this new ethics law?
Not the new one you have.
Okay.
I'll guarantee you that one.
If we were to take away
No one Oregonians, I don't think they would pass that.
If we were to take away the SCI reporting piece, do you think they would pass most of the major changes that we made to ethics law?
If you took away the relatives and the internet and, and that quarterly report. I mean, I almost missed on the quarterly report. I got back into Oregon on July 14th, and somebody says, well, you got a file, and I said, I don't even have the paperwork. So it's just, I think if you review some things, I think it would probably pass. Yes, ma'am.
Thanks.
Representative Esposito.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, thanks for coming, Mayor. I appreciate it. But Butte Falls isn't the only municipality in Southern Oregon that's bleeding over this. We have Rogue River that lost three of their commissioners on their planning commission resigned immediately. The sad part about it is in the city of Medford right now we have a vacancy where no one has filed in one of the wards, and one of the reasons given for the individual that was thinking about it was this particular issue. And that is unfortunate. The way we used to do it wasn't that bad. But since we have tried to fix it, we have made it intolerable. And unfortunately, we did what we did. But I'm glad to say I didn't vote for it, Your Honor. But we are at least in the process of changing this because of the outcry, because we're at 230-some people that have resigned throughout this state, and that's volunteers. And we've taken, in my opinion, a state issue and tried to put it on a local level, which was inappropriate. I don't fully think that the legislature, unless you've been in city government, understand what disclosures you have to make being a local counselor or on a planning commission or an appointee. Conflict of interest, you had to state those every time. Ex parte communication every time. I'm fortunate because I spent over 7 years on a council before I came here. So I understand what you're saying, Your Honor, but more importantly, I hope we can fix it for you.
Thank you. Yeah, the council members are lost. Just to give you a background on them, one was a retired public works director from Sunnyvale, California. Another one was a legal aide for a law firm in Medford. Another one was a retired social worker director from Medford. And the fourth person was a retired AT&T employee. And they all left, and they were all good people. And, you know, most of them want to come back on. So I have a problem. So
thank you, Mayor.
Thank you.
I'm going to bring up our host, actually, because I think he has to leave along with there's a panel that wants to testify. I believe it's, is it Helk? Mm-hmm. Mayor Helk, Mayor Carnes, and Mayor DeLong. And if you'd please identify each of your jurisdictions.
I'll go ahead and start. And since I'm the one that really has the conflict, I'm missing a meeting now, and I've got another one that's coming up. But I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I will be short, so we can get right to them. They'll be a lot more articulate than I will be. But first, I'd like to thank you all for being here today, Chair Devlin and Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee. We are also hoping that you spend the night and spend some money. So
I'm not driving home tonight.
This has really been, has had a huge impact on a number of the cities throughout Oregon, and it's in attending a number of the meetings where mayors and councilors have come forward to talk before the League of Oregon Cities and the Oregon Mayors Association. I'm not quite sure if I've seen it any more emotional than this, where you had, of course, like you say, 240 resignations, and you're trying to operate and move your city forward and abide by all the rules and regulations that, in many cases, the state imposes upon us as municipalities. I think that for the city of Pendleton, we have not been impacted nearly to the degree that many of the other cities have. We've had a number of our councilors as well as planning commissioners who did speak to me with regard to the concerns of this. I think we did have a couple of planning commissioners who indicated they were going to resign. Only one did. You know, we have the opportunity in many cases to fill those positions. I think that this is just the first wave. If it continues on, I think you'll find that the next wave will be larger. I think that through the League of Oregon Cities, as a past president of the league and a mayor-elect of the Oregon Mayors, and also one who served for a long time, I served 19 years on the Board of Education for the college, and then I served 11 years as council, 4 years as mayor now. And, what you find out in these rural communities is people tend to serve a long time. They're volunteering, giving of their time. And what's interesting to me about a lot of the ethics rules that you have in place, just seems to cost me money. I don't know how it is with you. It's not something you make money on. It's not something that with a conflict there that you're somehow putting something in your pocket. To me, I budget out of my pocket every single month just to be able to continue to move my community forward, and I know that many of our other volunteers do the same. And so when the changes have come out, and I've been filling the form out for 15 years, I really did not have a problem with the previous reporting system that you had in place. But I think that what you'll find is when the changes did come out, there was a lot of probably misinformation. There was a lot of confusion. The interpretation was somewhat significant. Instead of taking a chance on it and passing the deadline, many people just chose to resign and allow it to be worked out under someone else's guidance. As far as the League of Oregon Cities, they have 4 points that they have focused on, and a number of, based on the testimony that they want to press upon you as far as change. Eliminate the requirement that public officials must report the names of family members on statement of economic interest. And as you know, you've heard that before, for many reasons, it has to do with identity fraud. And I think that certainly as you put it on the internet, that'll be more significant. Where especially when you're questioning family members, your parents, your credit lines, it'll just be one step closer to being able to take your name and take out a card or something like that and ruin your credit. The other area I think that people have talked to me about anyway is a number of folks have family members who are in positions of security, where all of a sudden, whether it's military, the CIA, a number, where they really are not interested in listing these folks for security purposes. And so I think that you really do get into legitimate concerns when it comes to that area. Another step that I think that we'd like to see eliminate is the requirement to file quarterly public disclosure statements. It seems to me that if you're filing it once a year, that should be good enough. Doing it quarterly, and I think if you were to follow it up, I think you find that there were a number of people who just completely forgot. Because every year we receive that in the mail, it comes to individuals. The way it's set up right now, it goes to a body, and they're supposed to make copies and provide it to you, perhaps. I don't know. But most people didn't get it. And so and I ended up going to the internet and getting mine, and to make sure. And then I was reminding the council members to be sure that they filled it out in a timely manner. But I happened to be actually up at the college reminding them up there, because right on the deadline they had forgotten, and I know that one individual was past the deadline. And so to me, if you keep that in place, which I think is just redundancy, it needs to be sent to the individuals, not sent to a body who's going to be responsible to make copies for everyone or to have everyone remember every quarter you got to pull it off the internet without any form of reminder. People are busy nowadays, and it seems, I don't know how you are, but it seems like about every second is taken up, and having good reminders in place are good. But to me it seems to eliminate that would make complete sense. The third would be to clarify the definition of legislative and administrative interests so that it applies only when an official actually has the ability and the authority to benefit another person or business economically. And, you know, again, going back to the old rules, seems like they applied certainly more so than they do now. You start getting into what you find is so many times, you know, myself serving as mayor or a councillor serving on the council or a planning commissioner serving, how are they to impact? I mean, you can stretch it as far as you want, but it seems to me you need to get real with it and bring it down to where there truly is an impact or where we can make an impact versus the far-reaching impacts. I suppose that myself as mayor could impact each of you, and therefore I should list those. But then the last would be the reform the gift limits so that they apply to public officials and not family members. An example of that is say I have a grandson or a daughter who has an individual friend who somehow has business with the city, and they want to take them to the movie because they go to school together, and they buy popcorn and do these other things, and all of a sudden, somehow over time, it exceeds the $50 limit, the aggregate. I think that we've got to figure out a way, again, where it makes sense. And I know that I think you've all received this form here, and that it's interesting with what cities and counties and other agencies are doing through all the legal expenses that they're spending just to be able to define the gift limitations and when there are exceptions and whether there are not. And if you take the time to read this with regard to the food and beverage, the reception, the travel portion of it, and the entertainment, it's really very good. But the thing is when you're the average person walking down the street and you decide you're going to do something, and, you know, it's got to be something where you, okay, this is right, this is wrong. And when you're talking about a $50 limit, aggregate for a whole year, you know, folks are not going to Chamber of Commerce luncheons anymore. People are concerned about going to other, organizations that, perhaps like Rotary and others. I mean, it's amazing to me the number of folks who have quit organizations for the reason of that right there, thinking that there may be some form of implication that they can get blamed for just because of their volunteer service to their community. And to me, it needs to be something that is clear enough that it doesn't take a 40-page document. I think that there. I know that I think our city's standpoint, this the changes in the ethics rules have impacted our cities probably more than any other law that has passed. I mean, I've never seen this before in all the years of my service where we've had a wave like this quit and just resign. And then you have cities who, because of interpretation, will resign and then after the deadline be reappointed again. I mean, again, you start getting into playing games, and you don't want that either. You want people who are just going to follow the rules. And so I think that if there's any changes that can be made, those are the four significant ones for us. I know that a lot of folks, and me personally, that putting things on the internet, with all this information on the internet, for me personally, I'm not sure that I can handle that either. I mean, you get to the, if you're going to put all my, I have so much information on the internet already, personally. You can pull me up and pretty much pull out everything. if you put the rest of this on there, anybody can take my name and run with it. So, again, I appreciate you being in Pendleton. I appreciate you spending some time with us and actually demonstrating that to the citizens of Oregon that these changes have made an impact that has not been real positive. And I think we really overreacted to some problems that could probably have been handled in a different way. So with that, before I depart anyway, I'll ask you if you have any questions, and then if we can, Mayor DeLong and Mayor Carnes should follow.
Any questions? Just a quick one.
Yes.
Are you going to invite any of us to the Pelton Roundup this year?
He can invite.
You know, the tickets are under $50. So, you know, if any of you would like to come to the Pelton Roundup, I'll provide you tickets. And I will make sure that it stays under that. We'll try not to feed you, though, because if you go with the aggregate, you're going to be bumped. So you'll have to pay for that yourself. Anyway, any other questions?
Yes, Senator Brown.
I do. Actually, Mayor, one of the issues that was raised in a committee hearing I had in Salem this week or last week was the fact that local legislators typically carry campaign political action committees and use those dollars to subsidize the cost of their office. One of the issues that was raised in that committee hearing was the fact that local office holders, I think I would probably except out Portland, but other office holders don't necessarily carry large campaign political action committees, and even if they did, don't use those to underwrite their office expenses. Could you elaborate or respond to that?
Well, I don't think that we as volunteers, for most of our campaign committees, for any form of office, it's really relatively inexpensive to run, and most of the folks are probably paying for it out of their pocket, and so they don't develop those. There are those, I mean, in my particular case, in running for mayor, I did raise money, but it was all through there was nothing given through political committees of any kind that would impact. They were all individual citizens. Unfortunately, I was unopposed, so I donated to the college for scholarships. So so I'll have to do it again if I choose to run, but I got 4 years to think about it. But I do believe that if you're running for Senate or state representative, I mean, the costs of your campaigns are such that it's a whole different world than ours, and perhaps if you were to be looking for ways to focus on the ethics rules, I think perhaps your rules would be different than ours. You know, having served 19 years on the College Board, the budgets being larger at times than the cities, we didn't have to fill anything out. And you look at the school boards, my wife served on the school board in Pendleton, their budget larger than the cities. So I mean, I guess you start looking at that, and how does it make sense that for a municipality you've got to follow all these rules and others don't? I mean, I don't know. We're all fighting for the same change. I mean, money. We're going down there, so it's down before you. So I think that it's you're in a tough position, and I respect it, but I that's why you get the big bucks. You know, and from our standpoint, that's big bucks, even though you're very underpaid. So thank you
very much, Mayor Carnes and Mayor DeLong. Would you be okay to wait for a moment so I can go back to the order of the list, or do you need to go now? Okay. Well, why don't you come forward? Yeah, come up. Both come up. That way we'll be more expeditious, actually.
I brought my ethics violation with me, and I'll talk about it soon. We'll make it public knowledge. My name is Virginia Carnes. I'm City of Pilot Rock's mayor, 34 years as a teacher, 12 years city council, my second term in office. It only cost me $10 registration, filing fee.
Okay.
But I kind of want to deal with this from the point of view of the volunteer.
Just by sake of comparison,
because I'm the only one on here. $560,000, 2002. So.
All right. Okay. Volunteers are the heart of any community, but volunteerism in rural Oregon is especially critical, as we have far fewer interested and qualified citizens in our pool to enlist into service. I represent a community of approximately 1,600 residents, and due to the reporting laws, we lost 3 planning commission members and 2 council positions. That is significant as well as disheartening. When those positions were lost, it also became very difficult to fill the vacant positions. No one wants to put themselves or their families in an untenable position. The ethics controversy requirements are destroying rural leadership at a time when the survival of these areas is being the
money. We're going down there, so it's down before you. So I think that it's you're in a tough position, and I respect it. But that's why you get the big bucks. You know, and from our standpoint, that's big bucks, even though you're very underpaid. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Mayor. Mayor Carnes and Mayor DeLong, would you be okay to wait for a moment so I can go back to the order of the list, or do you need to go now? Okay. Well, why don't you come forward? Yeah, come up. Both come up. That way we'll be more expeditious, actually.
I brought my ethics violation with me, and I'll talk about it now. We'll make it public knowledge. My name is Virginia Carnes. I'm City of Pilot Rock's mayor, 34 years as a teacher, 12 years city council, my second term in office. And it only cost me $10 registration, filing fee.
Okay.
But I kind of want to deal with this from the point of view of the volunteer.
But just by sake of comparison, because I'm the only one on here. $560,000, 2002. So.
All right.
Okay. Volunteers are the heart of any community, but volunteerism in rural Oregon is especially critical, as we have far fewer interested and qualified citizens in our pool to enlist into service. I represent a community of approximately 1,600 residents. And due to the reporting laws, we lost 3 planning commission members and 2 council positions. That is significant as well as disheartening. When those positions were lost, it also became very difficult to fill the vacant positions. No one wants to put themselves or their families in an untenable position. The ethics controversy requirements are destroying rural leadership at a time when the survival of these areas is being the most challenged and the most difficult. The loss of volunteers from city councils and planning commissions at this critical time of tight budgets, challenges in providing even basic services and infrastructure, and guiding communities through ever-increasing pressures is devastating in rural Oregon. Small cities are the segment of government that is most transparent. In my community of 1,600 people, I see my constituents on a regular basis, with many of them showing up at my door with issues, with problems, with inquiries every day. I see them at the grocery store. I see them at the post office. They're on the telephone. The people of Pilot Rock are very aware of who serves it, and they are aware of that on a daily basis. They know firsthand if there are problems with the ethics, morality, or any other error on the part of an official. And if you've ever lived in a small town, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Okay? You'll appreciate that we're extremely responsible to our cities. Most of us have no bottom line. We're there because we want to make a difference, and that's the important thing to us. Local government is the most transparent because we're closest to the people. If you want transparency and responsibility, raise the water and sewer rates and see what happens. You have a controversy immediately, and you're real transparent. Our budget decisions are made in a public hearing with public present. Public members serve on the budget committees, and our budgets are completely transparent. The transparency you seek is not applicable to small rural communities because it already exists. The resignations I received were from dedicated officials who gave of their time volunteering to serve their communities. Replacements are difficult to find, and I still lack two Planning Commission members. I support the efforts of the League of Oregon Cities to eliminate the requirement that public officials must report the names of family members. I have a brother who lives in Seattle. I haven't had any control over him since he was 5 years of age. You know, I mean, this is nothing that he is in no way affected in my jurisdiction. Additionally, I support the LOC's proposal to eliminate the requirements to file quarterly public disclosure statements. This appears to have turned into an out-of-control beast, and the paperwork has to be overwhelming. And to what purpose? The officials who felt they had to resign did not resign because they have anything to hide. For the most part, they had served for years as volunteers with no pay, no honorarium, and no special gifts from lobbyists. We wouldn't know a lobbyist in Pilot Rock that walked through the Main Street, okay? In most cases, they bear the expenses themselves rather than charge the city. They were honorable and dedicated people whose loss continues to be felt. To uncomplicate matters, perhaps clarify the definition of legislative or administrative interest so it applies only when an official actually has the ability and authority to benefit another person or business. I would also like to ask you to reform gift limits so that they apply only to public officials and not to family members. Other than our immediate family, living in our households, we have no control over what is accepted and to what purpose. On a closing note, we are independent as people and as a nation, and at the same time, we are interdependent. We rely on each other. We support and sustain one another. Each person independently makes contributions that have far-reaching effects. Referencing the pebble in the pond example, the ripples are felt for a long time after the stone has landed. A boulder hit the pond instead of a pebble with the ethics law. The ripples from the boulder have greatly affected rural Oregon and will continue to do so for the foreseeable future. It is necessary to change parts of this law to enable our rural cities to survive and to flourish with competent leadership. And I did say I would tell you about my ethics violation. It's right here at the Pendleton Bag. I was asked to be a keynote speaker for the Confederated Tribes. Probably 150 in attendance. My community borders the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. They are a sovereign nation. Because I was a guest speaker there, this was given to me as a gift. Now, looking at each of you ladies here, what would your reaction have been? Would you have stood before the Tribal Board of Trustees and said, no, thank you, I cannot accept that? I mean, it truly does present and put us in a very, very awkward situation. When I buy David coffee in Pilot Rock, you know, or how are we going to handle that, David? He's gone four-wheeling with me before, okay? You know, I mean, things are done a little differently out here. But we're doing the very best we know how to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Carnes. And Dale, do you have any questions?
I'm pretty clear.
You can just stay there, and we'll go to you, and then we'll see if there are any questions after both of you.
Thank you.
Oh, Mayor Carnes, do you need to leave?
I actually do, but I'll give down. I'll maybe Phil call the Arts Center for me, hopefully. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm Dale DeLong, mayor, 18-year mayor of City of Island City. I'm on the board of the OMA, and so what I have to say, I have been asked by a number of people. We had the OMA conference here in Pendleton last week, and a number of the mayors of business community asked, would you please speak for us too and pass on the things, the concerns that they have. And so what I have to say is not only just from my point of view, but also a number of mayors in throughout the state of Oregon. What the ethics law had to do in my community I did not have any people resign. I had some threatened, but however, they did not resign. They thought that let's give them a chance. We'll stay on if they do something and if they correct us, and so they have a chance maybe not be so impacted. So I don't have any vacant positions. But the reason if they did resign was the reporting of the family members. Along with reporting of family members, I'd like to know what my 85-year-old mother-in-law, who lives in Biloxi, Mississippi, has to do with my ethics. Or my 86-year-old father-in-law, who lives in Scottsdale, Arizona, has to do with my ethics. It's just not, there's no reason to it to go so broad in family members. The immediate family, I can live with that, but then the extended, I don't. The legislative and administrative interest listing, I don't know. I think we need a lot of clarification on that. I do not understand and know just what is really down the legislative and administrative interest really gets down to. I have no problem. I'm in a small community, and I think that the people who most are impacted with this, the smaller the committee, the more impacts it is. And as Mayor Carnes says, it's volunteers that you're doing. You ask people to come, you know, and be elected and as volunteers. And so really, monetarily, it doesn't really mean anything to them. They're serving their community. And so that some of the restrictions that you're placing on them is really not fair. Really, the communities, my sister communities in Grand Mountain Valley Union County, in which Senator Nelson represents, have really been impacted. Elgin, North Powder, Enterprise, Union, and all, and they have really been just devastated. The planning commissions have resigned. They have not replaced any kind of planning commission. They cannot find people to take these positions. And if we don't do something about this, the next wave of resignations is going to be worse than what we have witnessed already. Also, one thing that really what they don't like to see is a possibility in 2010 of the listing on the Internet. If this is placed, any information is placed on the public domain, which is open to all the hackers or anybody, anybody can go on the Internet and get this information. Why can't it just be submitted if the SEIs are put in, whether it's just the city, the county, or the state, then they would be available there. If someone has an ethics issue, they can go to those places and get the information. You've already said that you don't have the capability right now to put it on the Internet. What's going to cost to put it on the Internet? If you can just put and file these just in the state, and they're there, they're a matter of public record, they can be obtained. A simple way of not having this available on the Internet. I think that mainly those are the points, and most of those are the points that have already been stated by others, but that is mainly what I have to say.
I'd like to jump in here and just add one thing to what Dale has had to say. What's wrong with filing it at our local city halls? I mean, is that an option that was even looked at as far as the SEIs? I truly don't know.
I don't know if it's an option that was looked at, but it would be similar in nature. I would believe some of you in cities would, your city hall would be your elections office. But that changed also because of the change in statute. We used to be able to, if you're a local city councilor, be able to file the papers, still file the filing papers with the city hall, but all CNAs now, I think, are statewide. So. Any questions? Yes, Senator Burdick.
For both of you, do you feel on the matter of relatives that if it were narrowed down to have just relatives with a legislative or administrative interest, assuming that can be clarified, if it was narrowed down to just relatives who had that kind of interest, do you feel that that would alleviate the concerns of people who have quit or that you're afraid will quit?
I think yes, it should, if it was narrowed down, there may be some places where some conflicts may, if a mayor's son, his business may be there are some places where conflicts, you know, could, but if they're declared, but narrowing down would help a lot, yes. It would.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Senator Neal. I'm getting the sense from your testimony that basically you just soon see this bill repealed.
Go
back to the old system.
Even as we stated before, if we had the option of voting, opting out, we get into transparency. The smaller the city or the smaller the community, the more transparency you got. Everybody knows everybody, or else you're related to everybody. And so, really, you already know. And so if anybody has a bone to pick with you, all they would have to do is contact the Ethics Commission, and you'd find the information there. Why do you have to have it put out to everybody?
We have our own neighborhood watch programs and communities
in Oregon, and it's pretty, yes, we're all pretty transparent. So. And I understand, the smaller the city, the small cities, we deal, both Mayor Carnes and myself and others, with small cities. We do with Pendleton, LeGrand, and then little larger cities too. But that is, we do have the problems, you know, of smaller cities, and that's really where the biggest problems are, with volunteerism and those types.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was concerned about your comment about people staying away from the usual gathering places, the Rotary, the Kiwanis, and these types of forums. Under the old law, there was a distinction between food and beverage that you received from someone if you were in their presence. Whether it be a lobbyist or a Kiwanis, there was really no distinction. If someone provided food and beverage, then that was treated differently. It was disclosed, but it was treated differently than an outright gift like your beautiful handbag. Do you feel that it would be helpful to reinstate that differentiation and to apply the limit on actual outright gifts rather than lumping them all together?
I think it would be very helpful not to lump them.
Right. You go to Lions or Kiwanis or whatever it is, and they ask you to speak, and then lunch is part of the thing. Mm-hmm. It doesn't fatten your wallet, it just fattens your waist.
I just want to follow up with that. If you went to Kiwanis Luncheon under the old law, were you always, generally speaking, I know, were you comped, or did you pay for it out of your own pocket? Did it really depend upon the circumstance?
My situation, I was only given a lunch or a dinner, whatever it may be. Never been comped for speaking.
So you would never pay when you go to Kiwanis or Rotary Lunch?
I did when I was a member, but then not after becoming mayor.
Okay.
Any additional questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will now go to Ed Glenn, Mayor of the City of Boardman, and it's Mark Stauffer from Enterprise. Will both gentlemen come forward, actually? Mayor Glenn, why don't you go ahead and start off? For the committee's information, Mr. Stauffer has written me extensively and is from one of the communities that actually, I think, sent us the most letters. On a per capita basis, certainly sent us the most letters and emails. So, Mayor Glenn.
Thank you, Chairman Devlin, Chairman Rosenbaum, members. I, too, have written and will not read nor repeat what I've written. I come to you with a tall glass of pure, clean Boardman, or Pendleton tap water. As transparent as we all would like government to be. But when I am required to file a document in Salem that lists 26 relatives, not a single one of them lives in my city. Not a single one of them who owns real property in my city. None of them do business in or with my city. And however it might be defined, none of them have a legislative or administrative interest in my city. And what's happened to my transparency in government? It gets a little murky. And then I'm required to file a statement of my economic interest. My wife's PERS benefits, my Social Security benefits, interest on savings accumulated over 40 years, a little inheritance from a second cousin who probably only passed through Boardman, income relations over which I have no control at all. And the water gets a little more murky. And then I'm told that this information, once I accumulate it, go to Salem. When the very people who are most interested in that information live in the city of Boardman. And how do they readily access it? Well, they may call the Ethics Commission or write to the Ethics Commission or wait a couple of years and pick it up on the internet if they know it's there. And when it goes on the internet, you've all heard how people feel about that. How much more practical it would be if I were to file that information, particularly the relevant portions of that, as I've outlined in my written materials, at my own city hall, where it can be readily accessible to the people most inclined to want it. So when I send it to Salem, it becomes, for practical purposes, difficult, if not impossible, for the very people who need to know that information. And the water gets a little murky. Then I'm told I must report quarterly on certain information that doesn't change from quarter to quarter to quarter. Because in small communities, and you will read that 70% of the cities in the state of Oregon have populations of less than 5,000. 50% of them have populations of less than 1850. And you just recently heard from the mayors of two of those cities, and will hear regarding another one. Now, those are the people most likely to use this information. And incidentally, I might say that the ultimate judge of our ethics conduct is made at the end of every term, when the voters go to the polls and say, "Okay, Ed, you did well enough the first 4 years, you can try another 4. But when this information is in Salem, unless you put it on the internet, which everyone has told you not to do it, the water gets a little murkier. And then I'm told that if I accept a gift worth $51, my integrity is insulted and I've got to squirt again. And I'm told I must police those 26 relatives lest they not receive a gift. Virtually impossible. And then I'm told, well, it's okay to take a $50 dinner from Mayor Hout, but I shan't not accept a $30 seat at Roundup, or for that matter, any entertainment. Now, I full well know when someone's trying to bribe me, and I should refuse that gift, whether it be of entertainment or not. On the other hand, I also know that among friends and associates who also might be doing business together, the public has a right to know about substantial gifts, and I should report those. The entire gift prohibition, particularly pertaining to amount and pertaining to relatives and pertaining to information, gives us another big squirt. By now, transparency in government has gotten pretty murky. If we all work together, we can restore transparency in government again, just like every city in Oregon provides clear, clean, transparent drinking water for their citizens. Thank you very much for coming to Pendleton. I must, however, observe your timing is poor. 4 or perhaps 5 weeks from now, I forget, Mayor Houck would have used his usual closing comment, let her butt. Thank you very much. I'll be happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much, Mayor Blam. Any questions at this point? Why don't you stay at the dais at this point if you can, and we'll go to Mr. Stauffer first. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Hey, my name is Mark Stauffer, and I live in the rural community of Enterprise in Wallowa County. And that's situated about 2.5 hours northeast of here. I've lived in Oregon all but 1 year of my life, and in northeast Oregon for almost 20 years, where my wife and I have owned and operated a small family business, Stauffer's Refinishing. I've always been an active volunteer in my church and community, plus a volunteer public servant for nearly 7 years, serving as a city councilman, economic development coordinator, city budget committee chair and a member, board member of the Wallowa Union Railroad Authority, regional representative to the Governor's Office of Rural Policy Advisory Committee, and a member and past chairman and a past member of the Enterprise Planning Commission. I am part of my community, and my fellow citizens know my family, and they know me. The rural community that I am a part of has honored me with the privilege and trust to represent them in various venues, and I have served them to the best of my ability. No one, I want to repeat that, no one has ever accused me of impropriety while serving the public's interest. Yet the 2007 Oregon State Legislature, without any notion of who I am, or for that matter, the volunteers that make up rural Oregon, have called our integrity into question. And with the enactment of SB 10 into the revision of ORS 244, have implied that we are unworthy of the public's trust. Most of us are volunteers, giving our time and resources to better the communities we live in. Let me remind you that a volunteer is someone who works for a community or for the benefit of environment, primarily because they choose to do so. The word comes from the Latin and can be translated as will, as doing something out of one own free will. Many good, hard-working volunteers have walked away from public service dismayed and insulted by this new legislation. The invasion of our private lives and those of family and business associates is without provocation. Rural communities know the people they elect to local representative positions and are quick to know about their inconsistencies or improprieties and are equally as quick to remedy the situations. The farther a representative individual is from their local community, the easier it is to hide these things. This is why I have always been an advocate for more local and less state control and have decried the one-size-fits-all mentality. ORS 244 has, as have many attempts to fit the one-size-shoe, created unintended consequences and set back local-state relations once again. I encourage you all to remember that it was the people of the state of Oregon that spoke out loud and clear in the wake of Watergate and with the creation of ORS 244 in 1974. The citizens of Willamette County felt the creation of the Oregon Government Ethics Commission was reasonable and found by a narrow majority that reporting at the county level was acceptable. However, all of the municipalities of Willamette County found it unnecessary for their elected or appointed officials to report. Members of the committee, the people spoke, and they spoke loud and clear. To imply that this or any other vote of the people is irrelevant, or that the people did not understand what they were voting for, is most certainly not a step forward in maintaining a democratic form of government. It is the voice of the people and the authority given to it that separates our form of government from many less desirable forms. We are a democratic republic, and according to the Constitution of these United States and the State of Oregon, the people are reserved the power to seat or depose any representative of government they feel is unfit for service to those they represent. Yet under the new rules of ORS 244.380, the legislature has given the OGEC, an agency of the state, the authority to override the will of the people and use this reserved authority to depose seated officials, cause votes of the people not to be verified, or remove from ballot anyone that has failed to file properly the statement of economic interest. In the case of the creation of ORS 244, an agency was created to police the elected and appointed officials of the state of Oregon. The people still have the right to police their own locally, but now the OGEC has been given superseding powers to that of the local people. Again, I put it to you that this is a step backward in preserving a healthy democratic government. When the state consolidates government, democratic form of government, it is the voice of the people and the authority given to it that separates our form of government from many less desirable forms. We are a democratic republic, and according to the Constitution of these United States and the State of Oregon, the people are reserved the power to seat or depose any representative of government they feel is unfit for service to those they represent. Yet under the new rules of ORS 244.380, the legislature has given the OGEC, an agency of the state, the authority to override the will of the people and use this reserved authority to depose seated officials, cause votes of the people not to be verified, or remove from ballot anyone that has failed to file properly the statement of economic interest. In the case of the creation of ORS 244, an agency was created to police the elected and appointed officials of the state of Oregon. The people still have the right to police their own locally, but now the OGEC has been given superseding powers to that of the local people. Again, I put it to you that this is a step backward in preserving a healthy democratic government. When the state consolidates government, usually an agency of the state becomes responsible for the administration of that consolidation. In creating this agency, a funding mechanism needed to be created to allow for the growth and expansion of this policing agency in order for it to perform its stipulated duties. I remind you that an expanded funding mechanism was unnecessary when local voters retained the exclusive right to seat and depose their elected officials. One has to question the wisdom of giving an agency of the state a blank check, ORS 244.255, to grow itself into an economy that is faltering, and during a time when the state of Oregon, and especially rural Oregon, is suffering the economic pains of revenue loss and change. In 1949, Albert Schweitzer said, "Ethics, too, are nothing but reverence for life." This is what gives me the fundamental principle of morality, namely that good consists in maintaining, promoting, and enhancing life, and that destroying, injuring, and limiting life are evil. No one truly knows what is hidden in the heart of man. With centuries of laws and punishments, man still finds a way to serve self and not his fellow man. Ethics cannot, I'll repeat that, ethics cannot be regulated by law of the land, but only by the law of the heart. I ask each of you today these two simple questions. Number one, now assuming you have filled out the SEI in a truthful and fully disclosing manner, are you a more ethical person today than you were before you filed the SEI form? Number two, will, as a result of filing the SEI, you now act in a more ethical manner than you did before filing it? Well, if you answered yes to these questions, then can you really be trusted to act in the public's best interest? Now, if you answered no, then I ask you, what has the creation and the expenditures associated with ORS 244 truly done? Well, I believe it has attempted to unnecessarily invade volunteer officials' private lives, rob taxpayer dollars from the local government, and ultimately driven off many good people for participating in volunteer public service. One of those is me. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stockman. Mayor Glenn, any questions? Mr. Stauffer, I didn't see in your testimony here. You did actually, trying to read really quickly, read the lower portion. You did actually resign, didn't you, from
I was the chairman of the Enterprise Planning Commission. That commission no longer exists, and its duties have been rolled over into our city council. I wish you could have been there. I really do. It was a gut-wrenching moment that the counselor is going, we don't understand planning. It's not our venue. We understood that. But guess what? I'm going to protect the privacy of my family. I'm going to protect the privacy of my clients, who in Wallowa County, I just about have everybody as a client. So you see, what this law has done is it's forced me to make a decision. Do I serve and return to my community those things that they have given me? You know, they patronize my business. They help raise my kids. They provide schools. They do so many different things. And this is my way of returning to my community and being a part of it, is to serve their needs and to represent them. And I've done that in a lot of different venues. And I've represented rural Oregon with the Governor's Office of Rural Policy Advisory Committee because I believe in rural Oregon. And I think they're getting shortchanged. I can't do that anymore. I have to sit by the sidelines. It's either that or betray my family. And I think all of you sitting here would tell me, well, you can't betray your family. And I let each and every member know. I called them and I said, look, this is what I have to do. What do you say? And they systematically down the line, all seven children, and my in-laws and my folks said, no,
There is no place for our names on that. We don't have any jurisdiction in your area. That's your business. We don't want our names there. So I was left a choice. Do I serve the needs of my community, or do I betray my family? I chose to step down.
Thank you, Mr. Stauffer. Any questions from the committee for Mr. Stauffer or Mayor Bland? Thank you both very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much.
Committee, we have three parties left to testify. We will go on, and we should be finished probably within the next 20 minutes to half an hour. Mr. Dennis Dougherty?
Dougherty.
I should remember that because I had a professor by that name, so he always corrected me. Please proceed.
My name is Dennis Dougherty. I'm a county commissioner in Umatilla County and a resident of Hermiston. Chairs Devlin and Rosenbaum are members of the committee. I've furnished written testimony and want to read from it so that my sentiments are in the oral record. I share the sentiments of my colleague, Commissioner Bill Hansel, concerning the new quarterly and annual reporting requirements established under current law. Certainly, there is a proper state interest in setting minimum ethical standards and assuring compliance. However, that state interest must be balanced with other interests for which the state also has some responsibility. One such interest is the state and local government needs for individuals to participate without restrictions that are unduly onerous. I urge the Oregon legislature to restore an appropriate balance, but I leave it to others to make specific suggestions as to what that balance should be. Today, what I want to be more specific about is a recent change to candidate campaign reporting requirements, especially as to candidates for county elected offices. The same principles apply, balance and proportionality. Would state interest be jeopardized if the reporting threshold were raised from $300 to $10,000? A county commissioner candidate should be able to self-finance the $50 filing fee, the voter's pamphlet fee, and also spend $151 getting a suitable photograph for the voter's pamphlet without invoking all of the statewide electronic filing requirements. Stateside, has anyone considered that some county candidates might want to run for office on a modest budget, not have to hire professional campaign help to assure compliance with these laws, might actually have other contemporaneous duties to discharge, and might be deterred from running for office by both the escalation of costs and the increasingly burdensome rules that are being handed down? I suspect that you committee members, as elected officials, know what I'm talking about. Frankly, the previous procedures were adequate, and the new requirements overreach. On behalf of myself and others, I request that you consider these sentiments and explore the rationale and effects of the new $300 trigger. Again, I'd like to see that trigger reset to $10,000. Having said this, I still want to welcome you to Umatilla County and commend you for coming to Pendleton to hear our thoughts. The thought I want to leave you with is this. You perform a valuable service. We need circumspect governance and thoughtful leadership. Neither circumspection nor thoughtfulness are supplied when our top-down laws get out of balance and drive good people away. Be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions?
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. And Commissioner Doherty, your comments, are you referring to the electronic reporting of campaign expenditures and campaign contributions?
Chair Devlin Rosenbaum, I'm referring to that, but the requirements go beyond that. The statement of organization, the campaign account, et cetera, and the complexity of going through these manuals and figuring all this out. You know, we're not all technology wizards. I happen to be at a stage in my life where I really don't want to become one. I'm hoping to last long enough so I don't have to. So I've had to turn to others for help, and of course these requirements also force you into some costs that actually drive these things up. And they're not necessarily spent on campaigning and getting my message out. They're spent on complying with these particular laws.
And Mr. Chair, I just would comment, I think we can all relate to what you're saying in terms of sometimes the difficulty of complying. And there are provisions, and you're probably aware of them, that you can, if you're going to raise less than a certain amount, file a form that just says, I'm not planning to exceed that.
Yeah, it's $300.
Right. So that is an option, but you're right, it doesn't cover very much. So,
Representative Rosenbaum, have you concluded?
Yes, I have.
Okay. I believe that limit has been changed, but I understand your other issue is that you'd have to file a waiver because you say you're not going to expend more than that amount. I think you must still have to probably establish an account, a separate account. And to be honest, even though you have the waiver, the moment at which you had exceeded that, you would have to have all the other records filed. So I do believe it's, and actually to understand all the regulations that are in there in terms of contributions and expenditures, I think will take the typical legislative candidate who has races each time probably 4 to 8 years, presuming that they don't change during that time, before they become reasonably proficient, unless they pass it off to a firm that does all of this, which is the direction that candidates that are expending significant funds are going to, which actually is, again, an additional expense, and a significant additional expense, to be honest, Commissioner.
Chair Devlin, exactly. Good comments. If I understood you correctly earlier, did you say that your campaign cost $560,000?
My 2002 campaign was $560,000.
So what defensible state interest would be threatened if I could spend 1% of that, $5,600, without having to go through all of that stuff? I think that I'm just trying to make a compelling, logical point that relates to the balance and the proportionality that I'm talking about. And I'm also trying to point out to you folks that, you know, yes, we've heard a lot about the ethics issues, but that same sort of mentality is creeping into a lot of other things that affect the civic life that we want people to have and to engage in. But what we're doing in order to, create this transparency that we're also talking about is just eroding the trust, the respect, and the willingness to participate in the way that we want people to do. So we've got to find a better way to create transparency and build up the public trust.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any additional questions for the Commissioner? Thank you very much for staying here this evening. Councillor Burke, is it? Are you still here? Am I mispronouncing it?
Bjerke.
Yeah. Bjerke Burke.
Yeah,
I asked for my advisor here, and she gave me the wrong pronunciation.
He's a Pendleton City Councilor. He's gone.
Oh, he's gone. Okay.
He told me that he would submit some written testimony.
Well, Mr. Garling, are you still here?
Garling.
Garling. Okay. Mr. Garling, would you please come forward and identify yourself for the record? And this will... Is there anyone left in the audience that wishes to testify? If you do, sign up now. But if not, Mr. Garlitz, you will be the final.
Chairman Devlin, Chair Rosenbaum, members, my name is Joe Garlitz. I'm the city administrator of the city of Elgin. I'm in the unique position that I'm an elected city administrator, so I can speak more freely than most city administrators with respect to political issues. I have served public office for 24 years in Union County, 4 years as county commissioner, and 20 years as the elected administrator of the city of Elgin. I'd like to speak to you today on 4 points. The first, you've heard a lot about, the objections of our people that both public and regular citizens have with publishing private information. And so I'll talk about that briefly from a bit different perspective, I hope. Number 2, the absolute inability of our people to comply with the gifts and entertainment limits. 3, the absurdly unfair funding scheme for the Ethics Commission. We've heard a little bit about funding, but I want to bring to your attention something that is terribly unfair about that. And 4, the basic difference in worldview between small rural communities and large urban communities, and the reason that uniformity is not a good thing. First of all, there is a fundamental understanding that private information is to be kept private, and all citizens have a right to their private lives. You'll certainly have heard many comments along these lines, and so I won't belabor the point. But I do want to state, though, that public officials of this state or any other state do not forego the protections afforded by the Bill of Rights simply because they're public officials. We still have our right to our private lives, and the state still has the obligation to protect our private information that is in its records, even for public officials. To make this point clear, I will never provide information on the SEI without the declaration that this information is provided under compulsion and is not given willingly. Furthermore, my reporting form will state that all of the information that is provided is confidential and is not provided for public disclosure. It is this single issue that has caused good public servants to resign their positions. It is this single issue that will prevent many others from standing forth to serve their communities. And it is this single issue that will continue causing public officials to tell the Ethics Commission to go pound sand. You've heard lots of comments along that venue, and so I won't delve into that. But I would like to add a footnote. It's curious to me that since the SEI requires a disclosure of every real estate interest that I might have, I can go into an executive session with my city council and we can discuss all kinds of issues with respect to real estate, and it's not disclosed to the public. So by what reason would I have to disclose my private transactions with respect to real estate when I can keep the public's transactions about real estate private? And keep that from them. Second issue that I would like to speak to you about is the small communities that those that have or might reasonably be expected to have an interest in a legislative decision or any action of one of our public officials can easily exceed 80% of the population, virtually everyone. Thus, due to the normal giving, sharing, and social functions for life in a small community, the other 20% or more of the population that is restricted by the gift and entertainment limits simply cannot abide by these rules. In our community, these rules are simply not workable in a normal life for either ourselves as officials nor for our family members. Normal social functions would have to stop in order for our firefighters, school teachers, EMTs, janitors, bus drivers, groundskeepers, etc., to keep an annual tally of the gifts received, and they will have to wear blinders and earplugs so that they are not illicitly entertained. The The third proposition I'd like to discuss with you, relating to the fairness of the funding mechanism. I must protest in the strongest terms the formula by which the Ethics Commission is to be funded. I understand that Scott Winkles of the League of Oregon Cities has supported this scheme, but in this matter, the League of Oregon Cities is not speaking for my community, and it has not protected the interest of the small communities of the state. The formula for funding that has been enacted states, and this is from ORS 244255, the commission shall set the charge so that each local government, local service district, or special government body described in this paragraph pays an amount that bears the same proportion to the total expenses that the amount charged to local government, local service district, or special government for the municipal audit fee under ORS 29745 bears to the total assessment for the municipal audit fee. That's kind of a gobbledygook statement, but it really is straightforward. On the last page, I presented the audit fee schedule. And you'll note that fee schedule runs from $20 to $400. The largest cities in this state pay $400 for the audit fee. The smallest entity, regardless if they have to file an audit fee, regardless of how small they are, pays $20. That's a ratio of 20 to 1, or 1 to $20. So to go back to my testimony here, this same proportion is based on a fee schedule that starts with a low of $20 and ends with a high of $400. This is a ratio of 1 to 20. The financial capacities of the subject entities to the filing commission, however, range from 1 to over 10,000. This means that for every $100 assessed to the larger cities, the smallest would pay 20. For my own city of Elgin, a population of 1,700, our audit fee is $250. Portland's is $400. Elgin will pay $63 for every $100 assessed to Portland.
Those budgets thousands of times
out of Elgin. This is absurdly unfair and must be addressed simply due to its unfairness. The fourth proposition. The original reporting law, with great wisdom, provided that each community should have the opportunity by vote of the people to determine if their officials were to report an SEI to the state. The wisdom in this provision recognizes that there are fundamental differences among the communities in the state, and thus allowing each community to determine for itself whether or not its officials should report an SEI. When I explain to a regular person on the street in my town what the state is demanding to have our mayor and councilors report to the state, they are immediately put off. When I further explain the new law, we'll then put this information on the internet, they are strongly opposed. My guess is that in larger cities, the citizen on the street will have an opposite reaction. Here's why. In my town, the people identify personally with the mayor, the councilors, and the planning commissioners. They know them as neighbors and acquaintances. As such, they see this reporting requirement as intrusive and totally unnecessary. There is nothing untoward that any of these officials can do that is not immediately conversation of the gossip chamber. The internal review of our officials by their public is much more effective than any report provided to the internet. And just as an aside comment, I think it might be difficult for people who live and always have lived in major cities, large metropolitan areas, to understand how our communities work. But in each city there are neighborhoods, neighborhood associations. It's that kind of level that we live with. Basically, our small communities are neighborhoods. And everyone in the community is in a neighborhood, a single neighborhood. So that's as close a connection as I think that there is to a metropolitan area versus a rural community. Officials in larger cities are generally aloof from the ordinary person on the street. There is generally no personal contact with the vast majority of the population. The ordinary person has no personal connection to the reporting requirements and gift limits. This then brings about a strong support for these rules, opposite to those in the rural communities. Thus, there is a very different view of this law in an urban setting as opposed to a rural setting. I would strongly urge the legislature to rethink the idea that every official should report. On behalf of my community, I request that the legislature reinstate the wisdom of the previous law and allow each community to make that decision for itself regarding its own officials. Uniformity fits centralized governments quite well, but is an antithesis to democracy and to self-governance. Our local communities are very close to the people. Our people are more than capable of deciding this matter for themselves. In closing, I want you to understand that I make this presentation on behalf of my community, Elgin, and its five planning commissioners and seven city council members who determined that they could not abide by these rules and resigned their positions. They did not take this action lightly. They did this because we little people out here in the hinterlands have no other voice. Basically, everyone from the League of Oregon Cities to the legislature to the governor was set on implementing this frankly unenforceable, unrealistic, and imprudent law. It has taken local officials, primarily from rural areas of the state, to call foul. For the most part, those who have taken this stand have done so without any support other than their own good sense of what is right. Adamant opposition to these ethics rules by these officials was and remains the necessary motivation to put Oregon's ethics rules back on track. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Yes, Senator Brown.
Thank you. Mr. Gerlitz, thanks for your testimony. My recollection, and you've got some of the language here from ORS 244255, is that the formula to fund the Ethics Commission was to be based on the municipal audit fee proportionality. Are you saying that the municipal audit fee is proportionally unfair?
In this case, it is absolutely unfair. When you're talking about the audit itself, you know, Portland's audit report is not 1,000 times larger than ours.
Probably more than that.
Well, it's not. I mean, the audit report itself is not certainly not 1,000 times larger.
Okay. But the city budget is.
The city budget is $1 billion compared to our million.
Yes.
It's 1,000 times
okay.
the size. Okay. And so to use this audit fee, which has a range of 1 to 20, when for my city it's 1 to 1,000 to Portland, but for many other cities it's 1 to 10,000. And yet, we're going to pay on a ratio, a minimum ratio of 1 to 20. It's absurdly unfair.
Mr. Chair. Yes, Senator Burdick.
Just follow up Senator Brown's comment. Would you recommend changing the audit fee or separating it out and having a different fee structure? That
well, the audit fee is okay because it only extends to $400. Mm-hmm. In our case, it's $250. That's a bit of a money for us, but that's not the issue. The issue is that the capacity to pay should be based on the fee that we pay, because we're funding an agency that basically relates to the size of our communities. We've got 1,700 people. Portland has 300 times that population. You know, maybe they should pay 300 times more, but their budget, their capacity to pay, is 1,000 times ours.
You're saying that it should have its own financing structure, not just be
it can't be fair with this structure at all. I mean, I understand what they were trying to do. They were trying to spread it out across all of the entities in the state, but this formula is wrong.
Mr. Chair, can I just
follow
up? I want to sort of just add on to that point about why we provided dedicated statutory funding for the Ethics Commission, and that was this budget, frankly, has really struggled over the last 15 years. It's been cut, been added on to, been cut, been added on to, and we wanted a dedicated statutory funding fee. If folks think that this fee scale is unfair, then the legislature should take a look at that next session. But I think it's critically important for there to be dedicated funding for the Ethics Commission, so it isn't subject to the whims of the legislature in terms of its funding amount.
I appreciate that comment, but I don't appreciate the source.
Okay.
Because our fund, I mean, basically what you've done is you've tapped into my general fund without any budget representation. Now, our own people cannot tap into our budget funds without representation in the on the budget committee. And yet the legislature, without ever coming to the city of Elgin and ever participating in any budget.
City budget is $1 billion compared to our million.
Yes.
It's 1,000 times the size. Okay. And so to use this audit fee, which has a range of 1 to 20, when for my city it's 1 to 1,000 to Portland, but for many other cities it's 1 to 10,000. And yet we're going to pay on a minimum ratio of 1 to 20. It's absurdly unfair.
Okay.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
I'm done. To just follow up Senator Brown's comment, would you recommend changing the audit fee or separating it out and having a different fee structure?
Well, the audit fee is okay because it only extends to $400. So in our case, it's $250. That's a bit of a money for us, but that's not the issue. The issue is that the capacity to pay should be based on the fee that we pay, because we're funding an agency that basically relates to the size of our communities. We've got 1,700 people. Portland has 300 times that population. You know, maybe they should pay 300 times more, but their budget, their capacity to pay, is 1,000 times ours.
You're saying that it should have its own financing structure. Not,
absolutely.
Not just
it can't be fair. It can't be fair with this structure at all. I mean, I understand what they were trying to do. They were trying to spread it out across all of the entities in the state. But this formula is wrong.
Mr. Chair, can I just follow
up?
I want to sort of just add on to that point about why we provided dedicated statutory funding for the Ethics Commission, and that was this budget, frankly, has really struggled over the last 15 years. It's been cut, been added onto, been cut, been added onto, and we wanted a dedicated statutory funding fee. If folks think that this fee scale is unfair, then the legislature should take a look at that next session. But I think it's critically important for there to be dedicated funding for the Ethics Commission so it isn't subject to the whims of the legislature in terms of its funding amount.
I appreciate that comment, but I don't appreciate the source.
Okay.
Because our fund, I mean, basically what you've done is you've tapped into my general fund without any budget representation. Now, our own people cannot tap into our budget funds without representation in the on the budget committee. And yet the legislature, without ever coming to the city of Elgin and ever participating in any budget request, has tapped my general fund to fund a state agency. So from that perspective, I have a real problem with it. I mean, I understand that you need the funds, but if you're going to dedicate funds to dedicate your own, don't dedicate ours. The city of Elgin, through ballot measure 5, took a 20% cut in its budget. And we've had to live with that ever since. And we don't have the capacity that the state legislature has to go back and change the laws. We're stuck with them. And so we don't have the capacity to increase our revenues, even if our people want us to. So tapping general funds out of cities is totally an unfair proposition.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
So, just as a follow-up, do you think it's unfair for cities and counties to pay any of the financial expense for the Ethics Commission, the statewide Ethics Commission?
Philosophically, I would say no, because it is a state agency. Practically, maybe there is some reason to do it, but I would think that reason would come back to us as our officials are fined, and the commission does levy some substantial fines, that at least part of that would be recovered through the work of the Ethics Commission when they find a need. But it's a state function. You know, it's not our law. We didn't make this law. You did. And you have your own funding mechanisms. We have our funding mechanisms. We're two legislative bodies with different kinds of funding sources. We legislate what we get for resources. You legislate and you budget for what you get for resources. But for the state, just because it has a big hand to come in and dip into our general fund because you're short of funds is totally unfair. So philosophically, no, I couldn't support that. But from a practical standpoint, what voice do I have?
As a clarification, Mr. Garland, I think part of the issue, I think Senator Brown tried to cover, is, just to be blunt, is to try to take the Ethics Commission's budget to some degree out of the control of the legislature. so that there was a source of funds that, so that the legislature, the Ethics Commission, everything in it applies to all public officials, actually before this statute and after the statute, was it just seemed, because of the history of cutting back on the Ethics Commission and restoring and cutting back, that it, we needed to take it somewhat out of control of the legislature, and to be fair, out of control of the chief executive. So,
well, okay. Again, from a political perspective, I can appreciate that. But you've heard testimony after testimony after testimony that this issue is not a big issue at the local level, when it's a big issue for the state legislature. It's your problem. I mean, this whole thing came about because of and the history of it comes about because of the actions of the legislature. It's your animal. You guys can do with it whatever you want. Just don't include us. if you want to put bylaws on your legislative bodies, I don't have a problem with that. We put bylaws on our legislative bodies, but don't put your legislative bylaws on us. It doesn't fit.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Any additional questions? Committee, we promised to get everybody out by 7 o'clock. We have 3 people left now. Will the 2 city councilors from the city of Union City, Pat Lang and Susan Briggs, will you come forward? And then Susan Roberts will be our final for tonight. Okay. Councilor Lang and Councilor Briggs, if you'll please proceed at your leisure.
We're from the famous or infamous city of Union. We are the volunteer city of Oregon. We didn't have much trouble when we first had to file for this because we've been filing for years.
Ma'am, sorry to interrupt you. We might need for the record for you to identify if you are Ms. Briggs or if you're Ms. Lang.
I'm Susan Briggs. I apologize.
Please proceed. Sorry to interrupt you.
There was not much problem among our people. We had one person resign and one person threatened to, but we talked them out of it. And several of us wrote letters to you way back a while ago. What I'd like to tell you is what's happened since. When we had to file, there were several who defied filing fully. And that was against our moral to not file as required. And since then, the city of Union has lost 2 people from volunteer committees, and we have not been able to replace but one of them. And now it is time to elect new ones. And we have 4 offices open, elective offices. Only one person has filed, so the feeling is not very good. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
I'm Pat Lang, City of Union, City Councilor. I'm also the City Council Liaison for the Planning Commission. This has been a good talked about issue with our both of our committees, the Planning Commission and the City Council. The only reason I did not resign was because it was not to do to go on to the internet this year, and my relatives back east are unaware that this is going on. I figured it didn't ask for addresses, so they don't know what state they live in, as far as the Ethics Commission. If I have to start giving details, then I'll have to resign too. My son-in-law didn't want me to give his name. It took a lot of hard talking to convince him that this is just on a trial basis right now until I see what you guys are going to do later. I'm not happy about having to file quarterly. It's just the same thing. Nothing has changed. And I didn't even receive it in the mail. I had to go online to get me a paper to fill out. And then I called the Ethics Commission and asked if it was okay, because I mailed it the day that it was due, because I never received the info. But I think you guys have gone way overboard on both the internet and the relatives. my relatives shouldn't be involved in what I choose to do, which is to help our town.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Rosenblatt.
Thank you. And I appreciate your comments, and I think that really is why we're here, is because we know that there's an impact that we need to know about and maybe make some adjustments. I wanted to ask you, just because I share some of your concerns about the quarterly filing and the fact that people didn't actually get anything in the mail telling them what happened this time, was that the Ethics Commission sent letters out to the sort of umbrella organization for whatever position you served in, and then relied on that level of government to contact people and tell them that they needed to do this. So, but I know what you're saying, because I had raised the same question. What I really wanted to ask you, though, is that one thing we've heard is just people don't understand why they should be having to file every 3 months when they don't have anything to report on this form. And one of the recommendations that we received in that report, you might have heard at the beginning, was perhaps it would be that you didn't have to fill that out if you didn't have new information. So I'm wondering if your feelings would be any different on that quarterly filing if you only had to fill it out if you had something new to put down. Yeah. That might make it a little better.
And I filed before the new one came out as far as the ethics. I had no problem with that one. But this one I do have. I have a problem with a quarterly anytime.
Mm-hmm.
As small cities, I could just echo what everybody else said, so I won't, but it's very true. We're small, and our neighbors know us, and the gossip really travels. So you don't do anything. And sometimes you accuse something you didn't do, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you both for coming here today and staying to testify. Susan Roberts. Ms. Roberts, you will carry us home tonight. And so
not literally.
He probably doesn't want us. I'm Susan Roberts. I live in Wallowa County. I live in the city of Enterprise. I have lived in the city of Enterprise for, since I got out of the Marine Corps in 1969.
Must have been 16 at the time.
You betcha. I'm a former counselor there. I served on the council for 8 years. I'm a former mayor of the city of Enterprise. I served there for 12 years. Served on the planning commission for 3 after that. I was the chair of the planning commission. I gave that position up to Mr. Stauffer because Mr. Stauffer came to our community and professed an interest in being part of our community. He served on that panel with me, and I was glad to give that role up because I'm running for county commissioner in Wallowa County. I fully intend to be the next county commissioner. Wallowa County has always filed this form, not this form, but the form, which I will do if elected. However, the city of Enterprise never had. And so when those few people were hit with this form, which you have all heard all of the story so far, the people wondered why all of a sudden they were considered unethical. When all the years that we have served there, no one has ever questioned our ethics or our honor. I don't question any of yours. I assume every one of you are honorable and ethical. There are some peculiar ambiguities in this thing. As we spoke to Senator, who'd we speak to? Senator Farioli. Senator Farioli's comment was that he would have to check to see what kind of authority was given to the OGEC. Well, that's a pretty telling statement if you don't know what authority you gave an agency of the state. And I agree with Mr. Garwitz, to allow them into our budgets to grow their agency is totally unacceptable. When we didn't feel we had a problem with our ethics or our honor or our morals in our communities, and I didn't assume any of you did in your communities either. The things that did happen that were not reported, that were caught with the system that we had in place, and a rush to reform something that we're now going to reform the reform doesn't set well with the public. In our community, we did lose our entire planning commission because we all resigned. We said we will not do this. Our planning commission then was rolled into the city council, and the city council thought long and hard, and they all, every one of them, questioned whether or not they would stay on. They finally did for their community, but they're not happy with it. And like some of the other folks, they didn't file completely either. So I ask you, if you don't file completely and thoroughly, and you get a letter saying you didn't file this completely and thoroughly, and you send it back still not filled out, and then nothing occurs, where's the teeth? I mean, why are we doing this then if there is nothing? Not that I want anything to happen to those folks, because I clearly understand and I am in agreement with them. But if we've passed the law, we have billions of laws on the books, that there's no enforcement mechanism. However, if we build an enforcement mechanism, which we read into this, then we are punishing the very people who have stepped forward to volunteer to do the work that we need them to do in our communities. And I'm not saying there's no more less ethics or more ethics in a small community than there are in large ones. So I want you all to understand that. Originally, when we read the first words on this, this would have affected 175,000 Oregonians. We were hard-pressed to figure out where those 175,000 Oregonians were. But we did figure it out. This law was not intended just to hit us. This law was intended to collect other boards and commissions, cemetery boards, other things. I serve on a cemetery board. I serve on a rail authority. I serve on a lot of things, and so do all the people that were here. If the intent was to eventually collect all those people, you wouldn't have lost 239 people. You'd have lost 75,000 people. School teachers, school boards, and that was in the original pieces. And when I hear that the school board people came to the meetings and were in your special meeting after the law passed, it rather makes me think that the intent was to collect all volunteers around the state of Oregon. Right now, I have a daughter who would like to run for a board that's being formed up in Union County in Mr. Garlitz's community. It's a rural health board. She would like to run for that. She would like to be on that board. But she called me the other day and she said, "Mom, am I going to have to file one of those stupid papers?" And I said, "Not at this moment. But I don't know if she will in the future or not. And if she has to, she won't do that. She will not volunteer to aid her community." And I dearly love her to get into this business because I love it. So when you go back and you have your other hearing, I do hope that each and every single one of you are listening and that your colleagues are listening too. Because this was not Oregon's brightest hour. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Roberts. One of the things about the law in question, there is a difference between the people that are required to file the statement of economic interest and generally individuals that are covered by the law. There are a substantial number of people way beyond that that are covered by the law that do not have to report. So I think what you would find is even though the basic things, which I'm not saying anyone in this room or anyone that's been in this room or anyone that's in any room that we've ever had testimony in has ever done anything unethical. But the basic premise of the law is that just like the disclosure of a conflict of interest, that in no case can you use public service for personal gain. But everyone is covered by those provisions in the law, whether or not they have to report or not. So that's one of the things in terms of the larger group. I do think it's interesting that most of the resignations were in Eastern Oregon, but there were quite a few in Southern Oregon. And in fact, I think
with the exception, I'm not going to, even those of us that have suburban cities in the metropolitan area, and I have five suburban cities along, had resignations. And it wasn't over having to file new, it was over having to file particularly the list of relatives.
Well, I want to say to you, Senator, and the rest of the panel, is that repeatedly we heard that our problem was we didn't understand. Trust me, we understood. We knew exactly what that form was asking us to do, and we did not do it. It wasn't that we misunderstood, we didn't misinterpret, we didn't do any of that. We know what that form asked us to do, and we chose not to do it.
The other thing is that the commission faces a very difficult situation that we have actually put them into, and that is that we do have people that have filed but filed partially. In terms of penalties that are in the law, it says that they may impose a penalty. It doesn't say they have to. But until the legislature changes the law, they still have to pursue compliance by those people that have not filed completely. They don't have the unilateral choice to be able to decide not to proceed. We're the only ones that could give that to them, and I think that's why we want some urgency if we're going to make changes in the law, to make them hopefully by the early part of our next regular legislative session.
May I submit, Senator, that you don't hope that you do it?
Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
You just would basically like to see this law repealed. You'd just as soon see this law repealed.
I would just as soon see this law gone, yes.
I doubt that the legislature will have the courage to do that. What's going to be the reaction within the community?
Well, I think you've heard today what the reaction will be. If the body that you all sit on makes the changes, as a candidate filing for office or running myself, where I'm going to be in a position where I would be paid, I have no problem filing for myself. One of the ambiguities was an odd thing. I would have to list my parent, her source of income because she lives with me, my brothers and their spouses, and my children, but not my children's spouses. Now, my son-in-law wants to know if he can get special favors from me because he's obviously not included. But when you read that, it does not say that you must list your children's spouses.
Mr. Chair, a follow-up?
Yes.
I mean, you made the comment, you say the reform of the reform may be worse than what we have now. Is that a point?
The reform of the reform comes out that the individual files, the families are left off, and I don't want to give you any wiggle room out of this. I just want you to dump it and go back to where it was. But if you can't do that, and it's not going to happen, then take out that portion of the quarterly file, take out that portion of the family. As a candidate, as a person who's put myself forward to do this, I have no problem filing on my own. But I do not see, and I will not include my family. My brothers, my daughters, my sons-in-law, and even my mother who lives with me. Because she tells me every single day, you're doing that wrong. But that's the invasion right there. That quarterly filing and the invasion of that family. And I can't see that any of you would feel any different about that. And there are, and I don't want there to be classes of people that because you're senators or you're representatives, and I was the mayor of a town, or I don't want there to be classes of people. So if you go in to fix, and we're going to have levels of whatever, and like the gentleman said earlier, I filed as a candidate for county commissioner. When I hit the $300 level, I'm filing just as if I was going to raise $500,000. Not any different. If you get into that section of it and you want to raise it to $5,000, Mr. Garlitz is correct. Most of the races in this state can be run on $5,000 or less until you get to your level. But the rest, with the ethics thing, either go back where we were, say, my gosh, folks, we made a mistake and we're really sorry about it, or here's the thing, we think we need this, but here's what we're going to do. We're not going to have the family filing thing. We're not going to have the quarterly report thing. You file the one report because you are the person holding the office, and that's it.
Yes. Thank you for your testimony. I wanted to follow up on Senator Nelson's question. He asked if you wanted to throw out the law. And when you answered that question, I assumed you were referring to the piece regarding the relative reporting. Did you mean throw out, the legislation we passed, the ethics legislation, included two bills and covered a number of things. Were you referring specifically to the relative piece regarding the SEI reporting statement?
I think, yes, I am. I'm regarding that piece that the volunteer public found so onerous. That's the piece.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
yes.
Another follow-up. And I know you were mayor of Enterprise for a relatively lengthy period of time, and we had city councilors from the City of Union. They've been reporting on the SEI forms since 1974. The City of Enterprise clearly did not, because they voted down, presumably, the reforms in 1974. Does it make sense to have different communities of relatively similar size, some reporting, some not? Or do you think there should be a cutoff in terms of size for cities?
No, because I don't think there... What I think, Senator, is that the law in 1974, the City of Enterprise opted out of having their... I don't see that that's... In the first place, I think that I read one of your comments was that we need conformity. No, we don't.
Okay.
Because our citizens don't agree with that. Our citizens say we don't need to have, we don't want our representatives here in our city to have to do this. And so did those other 97 cities and the six counties. If I'm elected, I will file because Wallowa County has always done it. And that's the difference. And I respectfully disagree with your thought on that, because I don't think that that's a patchwork thing. I think that was self-determination by the citizens, and it should still be that way.
And Senator Donovan, if I may, I think what I was referring to is that I'm not sure what the public policy, clearly folks voted in 1974 to opt out or not, but what is the underlying public policy that the City of Union versus the City of Enterprise, one would report with the SEI statement and one would not? That doesn't make sense to me. When we have a number of things at the state level that, we take a look at the state level. So I appreciate we disagree on that issue. So I appreciate that. So thank you.
Senator Burdick, then.
Esquivel. Then I'd like to go too. No,
okay. Mind. And committee, you will not hold the chair responsible for going back.
Yeah,
Senator.
Senator. Go ahead. You're the senior senator.
Mr. Chair, I've been in office for 12 years, and this is the first time I can remember coming to a hearing and not having anything positive said about the matter before us. I mean, usually there's two sides. There's the pros and the cons. They sign up on different. So just to make sure I'm clear on this, because obviously this was very comprehensive legislation. I know we've lost a lot of people in this room, but we still have a cross-section in this room. I would just like to know whether you or anybody out here from local government in the audience has anything positive to say about any of the reforms, whether there's anything in there that you think is worth keeping.
I can't answer for the rest of the people, but I'll answer for myself, and may I? For Mr. Stauffer and Mr. Garlitz. We took the bill. Mr. Stauffer and his wife went through it page by page, line by line. I've read every word of it. The reform, the rewrite of ORS 244. The original ethics law, I believe, was a needed thing. I think we do need to hold ourselves to a higher standard, even if we're just at city council level. However, no. The answer is no.
What was the question again?
The question was whether or not there was anything in the bill.
So you think there's nothing worth saving in the bill?
I can't say there's nothing worth saving, but there's a lot that didn't need to be there because it addressed things that didn't need corrected.
Representative Esquivel and then Representative Shields.
Thank you, Senator. I just want to say that no two municipalities are the same. I agree with you 100%. What's good for Lakeview is not good for Portland. And who is the accountability for and who is this for? That's the question I have to ask myself. It's for the voters. The ones that you represent. The local voters. The ones in that municipality, whether they want to participate or they don't want to participate. That's up to them. If they want the accountability to be local, then the accountability should be local. And no two municipalities forever run the same, and neither are they alike.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think one of the reasons why, even though it wasn't on the committee that worked this bill, and I've been appointed to this committee recently, I think one of the reasons that I supported it and voted for it when it came before is because it seemed to me that, certainly in my realm of understanding in Salem, that the public's business can just as easily be done around a conference table as it could be done around a lavish restaurant table with expensive wine provided by lobbyists. And I just wanted to let you know that coming here, I've heard you loud and clear when you say that things in rural Oregon are different from how they might be going on down in Salem or Portland or suburban Portland, and that makes sense to me. So I just wanted to let you know that I think there are some real issues that this bill is.
Whether they want to participate or they don't want to participate, that's up to them. If they want the accountability to be local, then the accountability should be local. And no two municipalities forever run the same, and neither are they alike.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think one of the reasons why, even though I wasn't on the committee that worked this bill, and I've been appointed to this committee recently, I think one of the reasons that I supported it and voted for it when it came before is because it seemed to me that, certainly in my realm of understanding in Salem, that the public's business can just as easily be done around a conference table as it could be done around a lavish restaurant table with expensive wine provided by lobbyists. And I just wanted to let you know that coming here, I've heard you loud and clear when you say that things in rural Oregon are different from how they might be going on down in Salem or Portland or suburban Portland, and that makes sense to me. So I just wanted to let you know that I think there are some real issues that this bill is trying to get at. I don't think it's right that a lobbyist should be able to take a legislator out to a $300 dinner, and I think that's one of the things that we're trying to get at. But you have been heard, and I think we are going to take these comments really to heart when we go back to Salem in 2009. So thanks.
Hey, Mr. Roberts, please proceed. Please proceed.
I want to thank all of you for coming all the way to Pendleton. All the years I was president of the League of Oregon Cities, I went down there every other week.
I know you did.
Visited with Senator Brown. So I do appreciate you coming out here and appreciate you listening. Thank you.
Thank you
very much. Committee, couple of items. I think I want to thank everyone for being here. Would note that it's a little late, but Representative, how do you say your name? Is it Bence?
Bence.
Actually, many of us that came here from the Valley, not Representative Esquivel, but many of us came here from the Valley, came about just about the same distance that I believe you live in Ontario. So we're about halfway, actually, here, just a little bit over halfway, I believe. So he traveled just about as far to get here as we did from the Valley, and Representative Esquivel traveled an incredible distance.
to get here. We're going to adjourn the Senate committee now. It's going to refer to my colleague, Representative Rosenbaum, if she had any closing comments. So.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair. I just want to say, and I'm sorry I didn't say this earlier, that for anybody that thinks that this bill passed because we thought that there was a lack of integrity or a lack of ethics on the part of the people who do this very hard work and do it largely uncompensated, that was really, I don't think, in anybody's mind, certainly not in mine, but I think I speak for the entire legislature, whether they voted for it or against it, that nobody was intending in any way to cast doubt on the ethics of the people that serve. And I'm confident that as we move forward, having heard what you've said tonight and at our other hearing, that we are going to be able to find a way to move ahead, make some changes, and hopefully make this work in the way it was intended to and not lose any more people from the work that we very much need and appreciate you doing. So I want to thank you. I don't know if there are comments from any other committee members. Does not look like it. So with nothing further, Mr. Chair, I guess we are adjourned.
You have no reason.